mean, I almost know all the officials, but for the benefit of Honorable Adams, we'll introduce, Honorable Abrams, we'll introduce ourselves. I'm Dumisani Gamede. I'm chairing the Trade and International Relations. All the members towards my left, from Shukela, will introduce ourselves until we go to the DJ. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Shukela Mtileni, and I'm the committee secretary for this committee.
Now, please, KZN.
John Gunda, Northern Cape.
Matsuka Godhari, Limpopo. BF Abrams, Gauteng.
Elza van Lingen, Eastern Cape.
Unit 7 is PNG.
I'm supposed to go to the acting DDG at the Department of Trade and Industry.
George Schneider, Parliamentary Officer.
Farid Shaffer from the Division Trade and Investment South Africa.
Max Tivella, Strategy and Agents Management, ODG.
Mbuova Matla, Acting CFO.
Sepiso Mahoti, Acting DDG, Enterprise Organization. Sarah Chwane, DDG for Group Systems and Support Services Division.
Okay. good morning. My name is and I'm the DDG responsible for consumer and corporate regulation. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Jody Scott, and I'm the Group COO. Thank you.
Good morning. This is one on this side. Good morning. My name is Siris Matun. I'm the Director General of the Department. Thank you.
Without waste of any time, I'm sure I've heard the new acting DDG mentor. I'm sure we've made, we've also lost from the department someone, I'm sure. But I don't see, maybe in your presentation, DG will announce that. But you can continue with the presentation. And before you continue, I'm sure Nimrod Zak, we'll have to find a place maybe with the mic in case you just got to tell you something.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with you. Nimrod will have to find a mic because, as you will see in our report, his division has probably the largest volume of work. And so I would expect that I'm sure there will be lots of questions that he will have to field. Sipho Zikode didn't mention the division that he's looking after, which is the Empowerment and Enterprise Development Division. We are missing Mr. Xavier Karim, the DDG for International Trade and Economic Development, who can't be with us. But we are a multi-skilled department. There will be people, I'm sure, who will be able to field any questions related to trade. The one phase that you might be missing is the phase of Tumelo Chifupa, the DDG for Enterprise Finance, what we call the enterprise organization, and he's been represented by Ms. Tsepiso Mahoti. Tumelo is on a sabbatical to do a master's in economic or something like that. for a year, so he'll be rejoining us, I think, in early next year. Yeah, thank you very much. As usual, it's always a pleasure for us to touch base with yourself, to engage in a strategic dialogue, strategic exchange on the work of the department. The presentation will adopt this structure. We will reflect on the economic context, some of the key issues confronting us as far as the economy is concerned. We will then reflect on our strategic objectives. We will report on the achievements against the planned targets. We have already in circulation the annual reports of the department, which will indicate all of the activities that we have planned. I will take those as read and just reflect on the achievements. Otherwise, the presentation would have been too long, as it is. So I will just go through what the results of our work in the reporting period has been, and then we'll look at the finances of the department, expenditure against budget, and then we'll reflect on some of the challenges. In regard to the achievements against planned targets and the activities of the department, I might just make the observation, Chair, that the work that you will see is probably the overwhelming majority of the department's activities, but it's not possible to capture everything that the department does. And there's a lot more work that we do in regard to consultations, interactions, advice that we give, meetings that we hold. So if you come to the Department of Trade and Industry, it will quickly become clear that this is a very busy department. When I walked up here, I bumped into a journalist of the business day who didn't know I was going to be here, and she may join us because she says, oh, with your department, there's always something to report. So she'll probably, or she may have left a mic in the room. And then she said in parting that, oh, I don't envy you for your job. But someone has to do it, and I'm happy to bring the team that is leading the department. Regarding the economic context, we make the point that the thrust of our work has been to begin to decisively focus on the binding constraints. We've always known that our economy confronts certain deep-seated structural constraints which impede the economy's potential to grow and create jobs, as well as to diversify and add value. That is the vision of our department, to enhance diversification, value adding, and thereby create the possibility for sustained growth and employment. All of that is captured in our industrial policy, and in particular the action plans that we are adopting. You will be aware that we are in the second phase of our industrial policy implementation plan, the so-called IPEP 2, which will feature in the achievements section of the presentation. We make the point that although the economy achieved probably the fastest growth rates in history, reaching at some point 5%, we have not been able to break the back of the unemployment challenge. And that, I think, in a sense, represents the central challenge confronting not only the DTI alone, but all of government. we highlight the factors that underpin the economy's performance and the outcomes that we've seen. The fact that it's been driven largely by commodities. It is still a very commodity-dependent economy. And that in as far as the balance between production and consumption, this has tended to be to favor more consumption type activities with all of the associated problems around the balance of payments, current account deficits, and so on. So the production sectors are not playing the role that they could play in driving economic activity. And this, I think, is part of the structural problems. We make the observation that in the period 2008-09 into 2009-10, which is the last financial year, the economy experienced negative growth or went into recession as a result of the global economic crisis, and reached a low of 0.8% per annum in 2009. But it quickly rebounded in the period under review. And in fact, we are effectively out of recession in South Africa. A whole range of factors account for that, which we don't necessarily get to, but you can see that the pattern of growth is promising and subject to certain conditions. We should be able to resume higher growth rates. This is just a graph that represents the growth of the performance, GDP performance of the economy, and you will see that from 2004 right up to 2007. The economy was growing at fairly, you know, a robust rate, but we took a dip in the subsequent period, and we are on the upturn going forward. We are confident that we should be able to sustain this upward trend in the growth rate of the economy. We're confident of that, and this is reflected in a number of factors. Investment patterns. The overall environment is still challenging, quite clearly. But there are internal factors that should sustain our growth rate, which we'll address in a moment. The recovery was driven by the primary sector, although the secondary sector, mainly manufacturing, also showed solid performance in recent quarters. This was according to the Reserve Bank quarterly bulletin, which was published in June 2010. In as far as secondary sector manufacturing, clearly is still a critical driver of performance in that sector, and the subsectors that we draw attention to, motor vehicles, components, transport equipment, driven by firmer domestic and foreign demand. The trade performance also showing some challenges there. Our exports have been under pressure for a while now due to weak growth in our major markets, Europe and America in particular, account for the decline in our export performance. But critically, the rand, the exchange rate is a major issue of concern. And as far as exports and growth is concerned, the exchange rate is going in the opposite direction, and that is a major issue. There is a consensus, international consensus, that we have the most volatile currency of all of the emerging economies, and that is a big part of the cause of our economic problems. The major multilateral institutions that were part of the IMF, World Bank, even the OECD, as you may have observed, have said that South Africa must address the problem of the exchange rate. So it's an issue which is at the center of economic policy debates and discussions within government and in the public domain, the exchange rate. The sectors that took a hit in as far as exports are concerned is machinery and electrical equipment, agriculture, and transport equipment, and as I indicated, Europe is a driver, the major cause of that. And I've indicated that the result of that is that the current account deficit begins to pop up as another problem, and the figures are there to show the performance in that regard. As far as investment performance is concerned, you will see that there's a marginal increase in fixed capital formation, driven largely by the public corporations, and I think this has to do with the infrastructure for 2010. And the private sector more generally trailing the public sector in regard to investment. And that is because of the general depressed economic conditions, as well as the responses of the financial institutions. We know that when the recession set in as a result of the global financial crisis, our banks also took a very strong cautionary stance, and in fact, the credit extension shrunk in the economy as the banks became nervous, and so on. That still remains the situation. The banks are still holding back because of the what they assess as the conditions going forward, and that has, if you like, a reinforcing effect on the depressed economic conditions. So it's something again that missed some other attention. We need to be intervening in some way or another to ensure that the private financial sector releases financial resources, because the bulk of the available investment resources in the country are in the private banking sector. As far as employment is concerned, we note that, there's been negative developments in that regard, with the non-agricultural employment declining by 3% in 2009, as well as a general private sector decline of 4.8% in 2009. The public sector saw a small increase of 3.7 in the same period. The major job losses were in manufacturing sector, 87,000 jobs, construction, mining, trade, retail, accommodation, and the services sector. The figures are there. Again, this is drawn from the Reserve Bank's quarterly review. Now, to recall what we've said as our strategic objectives over the medium-term period, we said that we will, by virtue of the position we occupy in government, continue to play the role of coordinating with other government departments and implementing the policies of the government of the day. And I think those are well known. We're not going to go through them. promoted investment and growth in the industrial and services economy, focusing on employment, to raise the level of exports and promote equitable global trade. And that speaks really to our international trade agenda, to promote broader participation, equity and redress in the economy. And that speaks to the work of supporting black people, supporting small enterprises, addressing some of the regulatory gaps and regulatory problems in the economy. And then to contribute to Africa's development and regional integration within the framework of the new partnership for Africa's development. These objectives will be familiar to members. They are the medium-term objectives. We've organized the work of the department in terms of these clusters, and this is our attempt to try and integrate the work of the various divisions of the department. And as I've indicated, the work around industrial development provides us with an overarching framework for the work of the department. We take the cue, everything else takes the cue from the vision of industrial policy, which I've indicated is to diversify our economy, to enhance value addition, and to reduce our dependence on commodities. And the area of trade, investment, and exports is the next big area linked to our industrial development, because we, as a small economy, to achieve higher levels of growth, we'll have to work both in growing the domestic market through broadening participation and including more people in the economy, but to also capture international markets, particularly high-growth markets, because we can't depend on traditional markets. We can't continue to depend largely on America and Europe and advanced Asia. These are countries whose growth performance is not going to exceed average levels of 3% for the foreseeable future, whereas Africa, the Latin America, and countries of the South in Asia are recording high growth rates, but we don't have a strong presence in those markets. Regulation is another area where there are a number of initiatives which we'll go through. And then, of course, administration and coordination refers to various things. The partnerships that we establish in regard to the government, departments, the clusters, as well as coordination with the provinces, and increasingly with municipalities. Now, to go into the achievements in regard to industrial development, our work has been based or has involved addressing identified constraints across several sectors, and these are constraints which we've identified through interactions with the private sector operators. We've identified key priority sectors that we have targeted, and the interventions involve financial support, other forms of support. It involves regulation, and then of course research to identify even more sectors that can benefit from the work of the department. And in that context, I've mentioned the Industrial Policy Action Plan, which we finalized and, in fact, have been implementing. We had also, at the beginning of 2009, calendar year, adopted this framework for South Africa's response to the global economic crisis. in which the IDC plays an important role with regard to support for distressed firms, and the IDC having set aside 6.2 billion for the subsequent 2 years. This is still a very important part of the work of industrial development and the IDC in particular. We've also been part of the work in responding to the energy crisis that's last year, having been part of the National Energy Response Task Team and the Electricity Growth Management Task Team, where we were developing criteria for new electricity connections, particularly for large projects. As far as sector interventions are concerned, the one sector where there's been a lot of activity, very positive, encouraging activity, has been in the automotive sector, where members will be aware we finalized the automotive development and production program, which is the successor program to the so-called MIDP, Auto Industry Development Program. And in that context, the key element has been the investment scheme, which we finalized in the period under review. And this has resulted in massive employment. The room was not announced at the beginning. We're very encouraged. Almost all of the major motor assembly firms have announced expansions. The recent one being General Motors, but from Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Ford, all of them have, once we finalize this dispensation, this framework, have all responded positively, and I think it's good. It's a good indication. The automotive industry is the leading manufacturing industry, whose growth we know has got the capacity to draw other subsectors in manufacturing. There are easily 12 or so subsectors in manufacturing that are dependent on this, from leather, plastics, steel, electronics, and the works. So this is quite a good indicator of confidence and the potential of manufacturing. We have done some work on the so-called agro-industrial sector, with your agro-processing. The BPO sector is very interesting, very exciting sector, which is where we've started a new economic sector from scratch through a number of programs, incentive programs. We've got the government assistance program and a training program, which has performed very well. In the period under review, we've trained 1,300 learners. Our target was 100, and all of them, the majority of them, have all been taken up. We are in our next phase of this training program, which is proving to be quite popular, quite successful. In the forestry, timber, paper and pulp sector, we are undertaking a number of initiatives there. The financial subsector is a target where we are incubating a number of activities. Tourism is also a key driver of growth in the economy, where we work with the Department of Tourism, the former Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. We are focusing on niche tourism sectors, and there are several of those niche tourism sectors. And there's also work around establishing a tourism export council as part of the network of export councils involved in the private sector that we have established and we work with. Creative industry is a very important sector, also where interesting developments are underway. We've been establishing craft hubs throughout the country. And there's a very nice project that we've undertaken called Mzansi Stores, where we provide highly sophisticated, highly artistic and innovative products for showcasing. This is something which we think will profile and reposition this sector for the future. Plastics, pharmaceuticals and chemicals is another sector that we've identified, and there are several focus areas in that regard. Biofuels, also an important sector, a number of projects that we've been working on. The metal sector, critical, the key activity there has been to regulate the export of scrap metal, which is a critical ingredient. The manufacturing sector complains that compared to other countries, there is a shortage of scrap metal because it's exported. And in a market where the price of steel or inputs into the sector are as high as we now know, this is a very important activity. All of this is currently with the Treasury, who we hope will approve going forward. The Industrial Policy Action Plan has an important component of leveraging government procurement, and in regard to that, we are seeking to identify fleet programs. And this means that as opposed to focusing on short-term procurement, we should be looking at how we leverage this area by identifying more long-term procurement. Our procurement activities are typically inefficient because we don't locate them in a long-term perspective compared to countries like Brazil. And there the idea is that if you have a long-term perspective, you are able to work with suppliers, develop their capacity, and as they develop that capacity, they're increasingly able to supply from local production, and the opportunities are here, as opposed to what we know is a problem of imports. The clothing and textile sector remains probably one of the most challenging sectors because it's a sector in distress, by and large. But it's a sector which we believe, in terms of the research that we have done, has got potential. We can retain jobs and even grow jobs in this area. If we focus in particular subsectors and particular activities, it requires us to create a supportive environment, and part of that is to strengthen the integrity for our borders. This is the one sector probably that sees the largest illegal activities in regard to illegal imports and that type of thing. And of course, there are a number of incentive programs that are available. Green industries is a new area. In response to the imperatives of climate change, we need to follow the trend of all manufacturing industrial economies increasingly seeking to go green, and I think here we have possibilities And that area identifies the sectors that we're looking at, solar heating, solar thermal, and as well as industrial energy efficiency program. So there's a cluster of activities that we are undertaking in regard to green industries. Regulation for industrial development focuses on the what we call the technical infrastructure, which is your standards quality assurance measures, where we've started a strategy and a lot of work has been done to upscale technical operational capacity of the technical infrastructure institutions. This is your South African Bureau of Standards, South African National Standards Organization, SANAS, your National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications, and the like. This work can contribute to creating a supportive environment for industrial development. Industrial financing, we've been working to align our incentive programs to our industrial policy programs, and we have revised a number of incentives, the main one being the Enterprise Investment Program, which is probably your leading manufacturing support program. It's available to all manufacturing sectors. Because, you know, we've got general incentives and sector-specific incentives. I've spoken about the Automotive Investment Scheme. We've also doing important work which has been finalized and I think will be launched with the Treasury to provide a tax incentive, a reviewed tax incentive, Section 12I tax allowance. The rest of the slide indicates the various specific incentives for different things for infrastructure, the number of enterprises, and their value. The value of the supported investments are indicated there. I've spoken about the business process of sourcing and offshoring. And the sectors are indicated there where some of our incentives have been deployed. The results in regard to jobs are also indicated. I won't read this. In the area of film and television, which is an area also where we started from nothing and have been able to really develop quite a growing television and film industry in South Africa through this incentive. The number of projects supported is indicated there and the value of the investments. Some of the films we've supported have actually won recognition globally, District 9, Invictus, and there are quite a number of others which are quite successful films. And so we're very pleased with this. The industry is happy with the way this is working, and I think that going forward this can only grow. The tourism support program is part of the enterprise support, enterprise investment program. This is sort of a ring fence for tourism. That indicates the number of projects we've supported, the investment and job projections. Then comes an area which I suppose is probably central to our spatial perspective in regard to the work that we're doing. And in that regard, it's the IVZs, which we have had opportunity to discuss in this house on previous occasions. There are the performance figures for Kuha, with four investors having been attracted, which are export-oriented investors. East London, with six investors, projected investment and jobs indicated there. Richards Bay, where we have now finally issued an operator permit in November of last year. We're working with the Western Cape government in regard to Saldanha Bay with a view to designating this IDZ, as well as with Gauteng in regard to the application for Over Tambo to be declared an IDZ. What is not reflected here is Mafikeng, where we are also working with the provincial government to designate Mafikeng as another IDZ. Now I want to move to the international agenda of the department, where here we have been taking a number of initiatives, both with the private sector in regard to exports, penetrating foreign markets, as well as attracting investment, as well as concluding government-to-government cooperation instruments, which are indicated there, the economic cooperation agreements which have been signed with Angola, Nigeria, Zambia, Egypt, Senegal, the bilateral investment protection agreement which we signed with Zimbabwe and in fact has been ratified by Parliament recently. We have concluded agreements with Ethiopia, Uganda, Burundi, which should be signed any time henceforth. In the region, the focus has been on the SADC free trade area, where we believe that that free trade area requires consolidation. There are a number of areas that we need to address to make sure that the free trade area works effectively. It has not so far resulted in massive growth of intra-regional, intra-SADC trade flows. And the trade still remains unbalanced, even though we as South Africa have opened faster and deeper than the rest of the members of SADC. We have not seen them take advantage of the opportunities to sell into our markets. And I think the central lesson is that we must address the productive capacity of the region as a whole. We must be looking at how our industrial development can link in with the industrialization of the region as a whole. Equally important is infrastructure, which we know is undermines the potential of the region to grow trade. We have introduced a new area of work here, which is in services, to see how we can cooperate further in the services sector, which also has got a lot of potential for integrating the region. In SACU, the agreement has been under implementation, a number of challenges also confronted there. Again, in that context, we have identified a number of areas that require attention in regard to productive capacity and infrastructure. With the relationship between the region as a whole and Europe, we've been seized with a negotiation around the so-called Economic Partnership Agreement, the EPA. We had differences with Europe on what should the scope of this agreement, and those differences have reflected themselves in differences amongst ourselves as countries in the region. Some countries went on to sign the provisional agreement with Europe. We stayed out of it along with Angola. And now we and then Namibia, so we have now reached, as a result of the visit of our president to Brussels recently, have a new recommitted ourselves newly to finalizing this, and I think we hope that this will be finalized by end of this year. The heads of state basically issued an instruction on both sides to finish this work. There are a number of initiatives which we are undertaking with countries in the region. I spoke about infrastructure development, so-called spatial development initiatives. And in this context, there are opportunities in Namibia and Angola to develop these initiatives to attract investment in infrastructure projects. With regard to South-South, with the agreement we concluded with Mercosur has been submitted to Parliament for ratification. We have stepped up the negotiations with India. We've been supporting work in the context of India, Brazil, South Africa, IPSA, in the area of trade. We have developed a bilateral instrument for cooperation with Brazil. We've been engaging China. And in our state visit recently with the president, we concluded a comprehensive strategic partnership agreement, which will also include cooperation in the area of trade. With the North, which includes the U.S., we've been working on AGOA, which we know has been a success for allowing us to penetrate the U.S. markets. And interestingly, in regard to value-added products, and so AGOA is very important to us. Its weakness is that it's time-bound, and countries can be taken off. Countries are treated differently within AGOA. We don't have certain privileges in AGOA, and we've been lobbying the U.S. Minister and I went there and interacted with Congress and the administration, Obama administration, in regard to extending AGOA further, at least to 2015, if possible, 2020, because the more certain it is over the long term, the more likely it is to stimulate investment. Otherwise, investors, if they feel that this thing is uncertain, they will not be able to access the U.S. market beyond the current tenure of AGOA. It will reduce what its potential could be. We are cooperating with the U.S. Through a framework which we call the Trade Investment Development and Cooperation Agreement. This was instead of the pre-trade agreement that we tried unsuccessfully to conclude with the U.S. On the EU front, we've been managing the expansion of the EU eastwards with the entry, the accession of new members of the EU, Bulgaria, Romania, as well as targeting specific cooperation bilaterally with some of the members of the EU, the newer members, such as Hungary. In a multilateral context, we've kept our eyes fixed on the Doha round, which we know is pretty much a troubled negotiation, but has very important implications. And therefore remains a central focus of our work in regard to trade. We worked with stakeholders around the 7th WTO Ministerial Conference, and our delegation included parliamentarians and members of this House as well. We've engaged in a trade policy review exercise, which is a procedure conducted by the WTO where they take stock of the evolution of your trade regime, the extent to which it is either they're being opened, further liberalized, or protected. We have been part of the so-called G20 processes, the G20, which is a cooperation in regard to the global financial system, working with treasury. We've been engaging in other bilateral, sorry, multilateral activities, the so-called G8+5, so G8 and the emerging developing countries, developing powers, China, India, South Africa, Brazil, the World Economic Forum, where in January of this year we had a massive showcase of South Africa, very successful showcase of South Africa, and in preparation or in the lead up to our hosting of the FIFA 2010 World Cup. We're engaging in climate change negotiations, working with the relevant departments, and are also inputting in the forums of partners of Africa, the so-called India, Africa, EU, Africa, South America, Africa, and the TICAD with Japan. These are important platforms for influencing the foreign policy of these countries towards Africa and towards ourselves. We consult quite intensively on these matters. Trade policy matters generate a lot of interest from various kinds of stakeholders, and so we engage in intensive negotiations and consultations in NEDLAC, as well as in interdepartmental structures such as the International Cooperation Trade and Security Cluster. We have done concluded strategic frameworks for our trade policy, as well as for our investment policy. Both of these have served in cabinet and approved by cabinet, and we have engaged with parliament in regard to the content of these documents. We were involved in a high-profile arbitration with the Italian investors, which was concluded recently in our favor. These were investors, Italian investors, who basically were refusing to comply with the BEE. They wanted to be exempted from BEE, and they didn't want to comply with the new minerals and petroleum legislation. So they went to, on the back of investment protection agreement which we have with Italy, they invoked a dispute which has been arbitrated internationally. But that's all over now, because they subsequently withdrew their case, but we insisted that they must pay our costs, which were in the order of about 50 million rand, and that outcome was in our favor. With regard to export and investment promotions, we have undertaken missions to Brazil, China, and the DRC. The pavilions are indicated there. We've had delegations going with the president, which are coordinated by us, as well as Business Unity South Africa, organized business. The numbers of business people who have gone on these visits are indicated there, the recent one being China. And by the way, China, we reached a record, unprecedented record of 300, over 300 business people that accompanied the president on that visit, which actually shows the strong outward outlook of South African business, very keen to establish links, networks internationally. So this, I think, augurs well for our growth strategy going forward. I've referred to some of the expansion, investment expansions within the automotive sector with Ford, which will produce the T6 Puma vehicle. And with that come in investments in the component sector. The next set of investments, major investments we facilitated is the Heineken Brewery in Sibibeng, as well as the establishment of new plants, manufacturing plants by Procter & Gamble and Kimberly Clark. We host this annual conference for promoting South Africa as an investment destination, the so-called Africa Dialogue, which we rotate across provinces. The last one was in Gauteng, with interest, the growing interest in this conference, the U.S., Turkey, the major countries are very much interested. And I've mentioned our visit to the U.S. For the Corporate Council in Africa, which is actually a very important forum to engage with decision makers in regard to policy towards Africa. As far as supporting our exports, we have begun a program to target small exporters, where we assisted 365 emerging exporters in partnership with CEDA. Our export and investment support program, EMEA, approved 508 projects, and as well as the sector-specific and capital projects, where we approved 18 and 5 projects respectively. We've taken these small exporters to the likes of the UK, Portugal, Brazil, Zambia, Chicago, US, Germany, and Jamaica. We've developed trade facilitation instruments like the bulletins, as well as expanded our network of offices where DTI officials assist South African business people and foreign investors with information in regard to foreign markets and South African markets. I now move to the next big area of our work, which is broadening participation. The focus being on enterprise development as a first big area. Here we've done some work on how we can leverage government procurement to support particularly small, medium and small micro enterprises. We've identified the 10 products that are mostly procured by government with intention to set them aside for preferential procurement from SMEs. All of this work is done. The Treasury has to come to the party to ensure that this is enabled by the practice notes that Treasury issues in regard to procurement practices. We've launched a hotline which is being implemented by CEDA to ensure that SMEs are paid within 30 days. This is a big thing. Even in Europe, it has been found that paying SMEs by government, government payment to SMEs is a critical to is a critical factor to their success as small enterprises, because it enables them to have cash flow and therefore to be able to sustain their activities. So it's no trivial matter, and we're very pleased. This is working very well. I don't have the figures, but I'm sure my colleagues will know how much we've been able to secure. It still has some way to go. This is the early days. We want to roll it out across all of national departments and all of provincial and local government. We have to pay SMEs on time. We are also developing some tools to support SMEs with information, the SME directory, which has got information on the support programs that are available from both the public sector and the private sector and the donor community. We have established a Center of Excellence for Entrepreneurship in collaboration with the FETS University. In the area of cooperatives, we are busy with amending the 2005 Cooperatives Act. We hope to introduce this in Parliament shortly. This provides for an overhaul of the support and regulatory framework for cooperatives. We propose to establish a number of structures that can be critical, I think, in advancing cooperatives development in South Africa. We, as a country, are not really doing well in promoting cooperatives, relative to the potential that cooperatives can play, particularly in providing, enabling people to take charge of their own destiny in regard to economic development. Cooperatives have the potential to help us, to help lessen dependence on the state as a driver of economic development. So we're very excited and optimistic about the potential in this area. We have already started to support a number of cooperatives, youth-owned so-called e-cooperatives and women-owned cooperatives. This is a difficult area, I can add, but the rewards are quite huge if we can actually succeed in driving this area. We've also, preceding the amendment of the legislation, have concluded the development strategy, cooperative development strategy, which has been consulted in and finalized in NEDLAC. On the gender and women's economic empowerment, we are designating this as a specific area for targeted interventions, and we have established a fund which is now operational to assist women entrepreneurs, particularly in rural and peri-urban areas, as well as a program to support small enterprises. SAWEN is a voluntary structure of women entrepreneurs which we've been supporting, and we are now proposing to reposition it so that it becomes much more effective. The range of enterprise finance and technology support programs, the so-called business supply development program, is very, very successful program supporting black enterprises with various tools and materials for their enterprises. The number of enterprises supported is indicated there. There is also a cooperative-specific incentive, which also the performance is in the period under review is indicated there. The small, medium, and enterprise development program has basically been closed. So we have some obligations to pay some of the enterprises that were awarded this support. But it's essentially a program which we have now transcended, and it's been replaced by the enterprise investment, a program which I spoke to earlier. In the area of technology, a number of activities there to support enterprises, the so-called TechnoGal support for quality improvements of small enterprises, the Technology and Human Resource for Industry program also a very important program which is in partnership with universities to do research into various niche and areas. We just recently had the awards, in fact, last week, of companies that have developed the most innovative programs in terms of both TRIP, as we call it, and the support program for industrial innovation SPI. That also included CEDA technology program, where we support incubation. And the numbers are indicated there. I won't read them. The community partnership program, the draft human capital strategy framework, also finalized as outreach program in regard to BEE. It's an undertaking, and the numbers of entities that participated are indicated there. In the area of BEE, we now have launched the BEE Advisory Council, which we hope will help us to further refine BEE policy and legislation, the whole BEE framework. Everybody agrees that the outcomes in regard to BEE are not positive, and particularly the broad-based elements of BEE, we're not seeing enough progress. Accreditation is a very important part of BEE, the verification of performance of BEE. We want to establish a universal, uniform standards for measuring success in BEE. You hear people saying, calling themselves level 4, level 3, whatever. Often this is not really founded on a solid verification standards and criteria. So this is work in progress. We are working with municipalities in regard to local economic development, and there's a program targeting 17 municipalities, which is underway. We have reviewed with the Treasury the procurement regulations with a view to strengthening them to support both BEE and industrial development. For those multinationals that can't do BEE, we ask them to do what we call equity equivalence. And there are a number of projects that we've been working with in regard to that. And the value of those projects is 500 million. And now we want to regulation. We've been undertaking a number of law reform initiatives focusing on the consumer protection, where we now have the Act promulgated, and we are working on implementing it. Companies Act also promulgated. We are developing regulations to implement the Act, Competition Amendment Act, which introduces improvements in the enforcement powers of the competition authorities. In the area of intellectual property, there's a bill which is actually in Parliament right now. The public hearings should be held soon on this bill, which actually seeks to protect traditional knowledge or indigenous knowledge. The regulations have been developed, as I indicated, for companies. For Companies Act, Consumer Protection Act. We also developed regulations for liquor during the World Cup 2010. This is in addition to having previously declared the event a protected event in terms of our intellectual property legislation. This is against ambush marketing. also developed regulations governing the sale of tickets for the World Cup. We started to work on the regulations for interactive gambling, but this is now being, if you like, preceded by a review of the regulation of gambling in South Africa, which is being finalized right now. We've intervened in regard to the distribution of funds from the National Lottery Distribution Fund to try and improve the disbursements and therefore the impact of those funds. We've done reviews in the area of state agency affairs. The legislation is from 1976 and has been superseded by developments in regard to this sector. The National Lottery also reviewing the policy there. I've mentioned the gambling review, and the report is being presented to the minister shortly, and after which we will engage with Parliament on in regard to some of the recommendations there. A number of research activities in this area of regulation focusing on intellectual property, sort of the holistic review of our intellectual property regime in South Africa, the effect of advertising on gambling and liquor, greyhound and dog racing, as well as the area of shareholder activism. A number of education and awareness activities have been conducted in regard to the Consumer Protection Company Act, the Intellectual Property and Liquor Regulation. We have been undertaking campaign on liquor, which involves raids of illegal shebeens, working with the provinces, as well as awareness programs on the opportunities associated with 2010 for SMEs in collaboration with the provinces. These are the enforcement inspection activities that we've undertaken in regard to various legislation. I'm not going to go into that, it's self-explanatory. There are 8 regulatory agencies that assist the department implement legislation and policy. Some of them are indicated there, the National Credit Regulator, the National Lotteries Board and Distribution Funds, as well as CIPRO. The latest legislation envisages new entities, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, which will take over the functions that currently reside in CIPRO, will overhaul the management and administration of company registration and intellectual property registration. The National Consumer Commission also underway, establishment thereof underway, and the National Treasury still needs to give us a final approval for the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. The final area of our work is what I've referred to as administration and coordination. It deals with issues of capacity, where we hoping to attract, develop, and retain professional and skilled staff. We have reviewed the strategic frameworks of the department in regard to human resources, the recruitment and selection processes, as well as the attacking the vacancy rate, which when we started to come to this house, the vacancy rate of the department was in the mid-20s and above. We are now sitting at about, in a period under review, 18% vacancy rate. And as of the end of September of this year, the vacancy rate is sitting at 17%. So we're pleased with the progress that we've made in regard to dealing with the vacancy. Because we have so many agencies under the department, the key activity that keeps us very busy is with respect to the appointments of boards, because these boards, change periodically. So at any given point in time, there is a board or the other that we are putting in place, or an appointment of a CEO or so of some of these entities. It's a very important area for corporate governance purposes and compliance purposes. The area of gender equity within the department is one which we consider very importantly. Women representation at senior management at the department is at 42%, which is a small improvement from the previous year. We are also pleased with our disability performance, where we have now exceeded a 2% target. But the thing with disability, like gender equity, is that it's not a one-off thing. It's not an event. You've got to keep focus and keep supporting those people, keep supporting the women to enhance their capacity, and keep supporting the people with disabilities. So it's not these achievements are not events. In a sense, in fact, we are challenged as to how we can maintain this sort of progress. Fraud and corruption are very important matters for the department, and I'm pleased that a recent audit by the DPSA of minimum anti-corruption capacity has put the department in a second place. This means that we are leading in regard to measures and action against corruption and fraud. We maintain a policy of zero tolerance. We take decisive action and we dismiss people. We are very uncompromising, and I'm pleased that this has been reflected this audit by DPSA. Again, this area is not a once-off thing, not an event. You've got to keep maintain permanent vigilance on this area. But generally, we are the least corrupt. What this means is that we're the least corrupt department in government. I repeat, because I'm very clear what this actually means. We are the least corrupt department. And this is an independent audit. We didn't bribe anybody to give us this sort of ranking. Financial management, again, here reflects that we are generally a well-run department. For 5 years in a row, unqualified audit reports from the AG. We're very proud of that track record. There are few departments that can claim that. Again, this is not a once-off thing. You need to work hard and to ensure that you have the controls and the policies in place to ensure proper governance of taxpayers' money. We could not advocate timely payment for small enterprises if we do not do practice. So we practice what we preach. We pay service providers within 30 days. We have now adopted the service delivery improvement. We can always improve. We are the first one to acknowledge that we're not perfect. We do have challenges. And in regard to the services we provide, we can always improve. We now have developed for the first time a service delivery improvement plan. This indicates areas across all of the progress of the department where we can do better. And we are implementing that. Obviously, ICT is a critical part of your ability to deliver services effectively, and we are also paying attention to that. Communication and marketing and outreach activities are important. We respond quickly to the media. Whenever there's a media query, we make sure we respond to it. We're not necessarily in control about how the media or what the media writes about us, but we talk to the media. All of these officials here are available to the media, including the minister. We are working on our website to make it more user-friendly. And we have a program of taking what we call taking the DTI to the people, where we go to communities and publicize our activities. We are also, as I indicated, part of the MINMEC, which means once a quarter to coordinate our work programs. Our deputy minister in the year under review undertook visits to all of the provinces to identify areas of interface between ourselves and the provinces and how we can improve. We will shortly be bringing that report, the report of her visit to Parliament and to this House, I'm sure, so we can engage with what her findings were. I've spoken about the clusters. We have established forums for engaging with the private sector. The minister meets with industry CEOs on a regular basis, what we call the manufacturing cycle. These are manufacturers who give us feedback on some of the challenges and how the department and government might assist. Now, as a way of concluding with the presentation, Chair, I want to reflect what one might call like a provincial perspective to the work of the department. Some of the sectors identified in the industrial policy action plan and some of our incentives have a very, and of course the work on broadening participation, have very strong provincial or spatial dimensions to them. In regard to this incentive, which I refer to the Black Business Supply Development Program, the Cooperative Incentive Scheme, this is the spread of the take-up of these two incentives. I'm not going to read the figures. I think they are self-explanatory. The investment incentives uptake is indicated there. And finally, the export marketing and investment incentive is also indicated there. But of course, we are happy to engage further with yourselves on what the sort of provincial, spatial perspective of our work entails. I can only just say, in regard to spatial perspective of our work, that we need to develop a clear framework for our work on the spatial economy. This constitute of disparate sort of initiatives and programs not fully located within a strategic framework. This is a major gap. We had started work, which many of you will recall, that we call the Regional Industrial Development Strategy, REIDS, that began to propose particular approaches, particular instruments and so on. But it never really went far. I think we need to revisit that work along with the provinces, and the MINMEC will play an important role in regard to that. And I think this house as well will play an important role. We need a clear framework for dealing with a spatial economy. Because we know that if we don't do that, then the patterns, the uneven patterns of economic development in our country will persist. So we pose this as a challenge to ourselves, but it's clearly a challenge that we need to tackle as government as a whole, along with other government departments, because all of us collectively can make a difference if we work off a common sort of framework around the spatial economy. I conclude by highlighting some of the challenges that we confront as a department. In the period under review, we were all engaged with the reorganization of government, setting up new departments and so on. And for us, we had to assist this new department called Economic Development Department. We assist them to set up and so on and so forth. So they relied on our infrastructure for recruitment, for procurement and that type of thing. The effects of the recession clearly affected our work in many ways. When you look at the incentives take up, you will see that some of the incentives were not taken up very strongly as a result of the recession. We still have some way to go in enhancing capacity of the department. The capacity in the department is uneven. There are some good officials that work hard and have the skills and apply themselves. There are other officials who are struggling, and there are important gaps in our capacity that we remain seized with. If you look at our budget in the moment, you will see that we can do with a lot more financial resources. We can do with more financial resources if we are to more effectively achieve our objectives. There is a budget. You will see that there's been in the last 5 years, it is a 5-year perspective of our budget. Steady growth going forward. The interesting thing is that we spend the money allocated to us. Our other expenditure is within the regulated target. But I think that generally, the department can do with more resources, and the more resources we can secure, the more we can be more effective as a department. This is a breakdown of our budget. I'm not going to go into it, Chair, because I think it's fairly self-explanatory. I conclude my presentation by thanking you for your attention. And we look forward to engagement. My colleagues are here, the DDGs, responsible for various programs who can help deal with any questions that you may have. I thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you very much, DG. There are some officials or people from the media that didn't introduce themselves. Then after that, there are some members who joined us who must introduce themselves. Can I give that opportunity now to some officials that joined us later when we introduce themselves? Now, if you haven't introduced yourself, you know. Just introduce yourself.
I am Johan de Klerk. I'm a researcher in Parliament.
I'm Jean Redeval. I'm from the financial media and a member of the Parliamentary Press Gallery.
Thank you. Honourable members, introduce yourself.
Kenneth Tumke, Northern Cape.
Jomonyambi, Mpumalanga.
That's all. Okay. Thanks very much, DG, for that briefing. I'll note the names. I see Honorable Kunda would want to break the ice. Who else would want to follow? Honorable Adam, Abraham. Never mind, I'll get used to it. Honorable Nyambi. Mazambane, Honorable Liz, Honorable Sinclair. I'm sure in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, let me start and congratulate the DG with a well-documented presentation and briefing to the Select Committee. A very good presentation on paper, an excellent one, a very, very good one. Thanks and congratulations to the Auditor General's opinion. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Now, I've got a few questions. I think I've got a lot of them. I think I've got 13 questions. But I'll make it very quick. First, let me start with your financial institutions that are there to support your mandate. This department is crucial, not only for Africa and the world, but first of all, this department is crucial for South Africa. And by that I mean the people of this country. And by that I mean the historically disadvantaged South Africans of this country. And I'm going to base my questions on that. And I will start by, I will start with your last pages, first page, 52, 53, and 54. You see the arrow there on the map. It just shows Kimberley in the Northern Cape, as if Kimberley is the Northern Cape. And all the departments, including the NAF, the people that are supposed to support your mandate, including IDC, including Kula. These people are concentrating on Kimberley. They don't concentrate on the Northern Cape. And the relationships are vast. Very, very vast. In the area where I'm coming from, there's a lot of people with business minds who have given me, I think, more than 1,000 business plans which has never been assisted. I'm coming from Uppington. I've traveled the Northern Cape. In 1 year, I've traveled more than 111,000 kilometers by car. So I know what I'm talking about. And I've seen the suffering of our people in that province. Let's start with page 9. There's something, your slide 9 there. Can you, the job losses, the major job losses in manufacturing and that, can you just tell us what? Why is it happening like that? Page 11, your slide 11. Bullet point 2. Promoting direct investment and growth in the industrial and service economy will particularly focus on employment and creation. There's another question. There's a big challenge there. Are you succeeding in this, and what are the challenges really? Slide 14 and slide 21 got the same question. Bullet point 2 again, the implementation of the framework to SA response to the global economic crisis focuses on the IDC fund of $6.2 billion for distressed firms. How many of the the historical disadvantaged firms have been benefited from this, fund? Let me just get the one on 21. The one on 21 is also your slide 21. It's more or less the same question about how many of our people have been benefited from this. And then we go to page your slide 18. The last bullet point 3, in the clothing and textile competitiveness program, can you be honest with us, what is the real challenge here? And have you checked the imports? You concentrating only on three things. Have you checked the imports also from China as well? Then slide 22. Bullet point 3. The manufacturing investment program, they said, has supported 290 projects, leveraging investment of 6.1. Those projects that are on paper, how genuine are they, and is there proof that the previously disadvantaged communities have benefited from this? Slide 31. Bullet point 3, again. 183 new small exports were existed to promote. Let me just explain to you. During our visit now in China, when were we in China, Honorable Chen?
We're in China when we're with you in China.
In July, ne?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, in July, during my breakfast, I met, I can't remember the young man's name now. They were there for business in China as well. There was a certain lady, particularly when you came on this point, that thing came back to me. There was a certain lady that has been taken here from, I think, from the department to China to go and show what she can do and all that. Now my question is, and she did not have, she was not really capacitated. My question is, have you made sure that these small entrepreneurs are fully equipped to do international trade, and is the market sustainable for them? The other question is, how many of these SMEs are privileged advantage from, and from which areas are they, urban and rural? I've seen you said some of the most rural provinces you've used, it's fine. And are they from the whole country? That's 31, 35. Yes, bullet point 3. The society that you are mentioning there, now the first one, how can the people have access to this fund and what's it consulted with our communities? 35. The second bullet point. 34 million. And then the other one is 39. Slide 39. Bullet point 3, 17 district municipalities were supported to develop LEDs. Can you tell us about those municipalities, the district municipalities? And then that's the last bullet point on that very same slide 39. Three equity equivalent investment programs have been approved, totaling 500 million rand. What do you mean by that, and can you please clarify that to us? Please break it down for me. I need to understand that so that I can have a better question on that. Thank you. And then the other one is on page, slide 50. Now 41. The last bullet point there, to provide guidance for improved distribution of national lottery fund. Why is it difficult to access this fund? And is the legislation or the regulations being changed to that this fund can assist previously disadvantaged schools where there is no activities, sports facilities for the previous disadvantaged schools. Is there anything that the regulation has been changed concerning this one? Because the last time we were there last year, they said they had 4.1 billion rand to distribute, and I don't know, did they distribute 4.1 billion rand already? That's the lottery fund. And then, I think that was my last slide. Let me just make, yes. The other question I would like to ask. Your service provider, it's a good thing that you pay them in within 30 days. It's an excellent. Your service providers, are they from the previously disadvantaged people? And I'm not talking about cleaners now. I'm not talking about people who are cleaning. I'm talking about service providers, people who supply goods to the department. Are they from the previously disadvantaged people? I thank you, Chair.
Yes, you know, Honorable Gunda is a pastor, so you travel about 100 kilometers in a year. But there's a member who didn't introduce himself.
Thank you, Jefferson. My name is Freddie Adams. I'm the permanent delegate of the Western Cape. Thank you very much.
You know, Honorable Adams is the one who took the other five institutions. He's the chair of economic development. He demanded them. So, Honorable Adams.
Thank you, Jefferson. I've noticed that on slide 33, 100 youth owned cooperatives and 20 women owned cooperatives received assistance. What are you doing with the people with a disability? I see if you haven't included them as cooperatives. Thank you.
Chairperson. Let me join and welcome the detailed presentation and congratulate the department for what they've achieved for the past 5 years. Despite the fact that we know there was this global recession, it's a fact that we are not going to come here and celebrate when we get the report that is indicating that in the last financial year, if my calculation is correct, it's reflecting that it's almost 1 million people that lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. If you do the calculation and take all the numbers that they are indicating, right from clothing, manufacturing, you can see that it's more than 400,000, so it's almost 500,000, of which it's a real challenge. Be that as it may, the department in the last financial, in the previous financial year, there are issues that were raised. It's very good, Chairperson, that you can see what there is an improvement, and it's leading us towards the right direction. We raise the issue of disability, there's improvement. But if you can check from the report where you are dealing with the posts that are being upgraded, I can say you have upgraded more than 90% for males. When it comes to females, it's less than 2%. When it comes to people with disability, it's zero. It's on this report. Why is the case? And when you check people leaving the department, you have even the reason. Maybe if I can get a little bit of elaboration to understand why a meaningful percentage of people that are leaving the department, it's more about resignation, why people are resigning. Because in almost all of those that left the department, very few, tiny percentage is death, tiny percentage those that were dismissed, but meaningful percentage is those that resigned. Why is the case? Not even those that were transferred. If you can compare those that were transferred to those that resigned, you can see the difference. The other thing, we are mindful and aware that there is no way that we can say, let's totally do away with consultants. But we are always making an emphasis that where it's possible, it has to be an in-house thing. We are raising it on very many a times that we have to do it as government. But there are things that we have to get service providers. Well, what is quite clear in this report is that you have even assisted us because we're even able to break in terms of historically disadvantaged and giving a number of percentage, of which is very clear. But you have spent more than 20 million paying consultants. My question is the more than 20 million, including the money that is coming from the donors, or is excluding that? And if it's excluding, if we are going to include that amount, what will be the total amount if that money is excluding the one that you got from the donors? And I'm raising this thing of consultants because in some other instances you'll have where you are referring a legal matter. I might not be a legal person, but there are things that we know as a fact that you have that unit in a department. And if you even check the amount that has been spent, in some other instances you'll get that it's less than 20,000. It's around 18,000, 15,000. Obvious indication that it was not something. But in a situation where you see that you have to deal with legislation, you're dealing with gambling, you're dealing with whatever, where you have to spend around 400 and something, it's clear that it was something that was not going to be possible for you to do it in-house. So I'm making that emphasis that we made in the previous report. And if you can go to page 138 in your report, if you can assist and clarify, because you have the report on consultants appointed using appropriated funds. Where you have the date, you have, if you can go to where you have similar dates, like 5 July, 5 July, and is the project title is the same. It's the only difference is the duration and the contract value in terms of rent. To make it for me to understand, because I've got my own interpretation of this thing, but let me not say it and reserve whatever that I might say until you clarify so that I can understand it better. It's not, I'm using that as an example, but it's not the only one. You have, I think, 4 or 5 where you'll have same date and, same project title. The only difference is the contract value, of which it's when... I'll come back to deal with that once we have... clarify that part. Then the other question is in relation to your SM, your management, not signing performance agreement. Well, I was not relying so much on what you presented, because I must thank you, the department chairperson, for us to get the document in time. It makes us to be ready, even if it's doing presentation, but it's very simple to follow the presentation if you have gone through the report. And we got it in time. We had an opportunity to go through it. Where you are dealing with the
part of management that hasn't signed their performance agreement. And the report is so good that you're even giving us the reason. But let me be upfront, Chairperson, and say some of the reasons are not convincing why you have those that haven't signed performance agreement. It's good we have reasons. We have cases where the reasons are very genuine. But DG, some of the reasons are not convincing. I'll be happy if you can comment on that. I'm saying some of the reasons are not convincing. Of course, we have reasons that are very genuine and that we understand. Then the last part, for the wonderful job you're doing, DG, it's good to acknowledge that you still have some challenges. There are things that we have to improve on. But for you to say, to celebrate that we are commending the department for what the Auditor General has said about the performance and everything. But it's my opinion. For you to celebrate that you are least corrupt, you are acknowledging that you are corrupt, but you are just the least corrupt. So you have to have a way of presenting it in a way that will show that you are against it. And you have done a lot of things to prove that you are dealing with those that are corrupt. But my last part, Chairperson, is if you can allow them to assist and interpret where they are dealing with internal control from the AG. Let me quote as is. I quote, "I consider internal control relevant to my audit of the financial statement and the report on predetermined objectives and compliance with the PFMA, but not for the purposes of expressing an opinion on the effectiveness of internal control," close quote. If that can be unpacked for me to have an understanding of what is the AG trying to tell us about this point. Thanks, Chairperson. The last part is 269. If you can go to 269. That's the part of the AG. Just on top of the signature. I've read it as is, the first sentence. And if you can just assist us and unpack it for us to be able to understand. Thanks, Chairperson.
Honorable this.
Chairman, I'll go as quickly as I can. I am very pleased to hear that Honourable Nyambi has taken the trouble to read this report because it's a very glossy and very comprehensive report. I differ with them in the sense that I don't think we had enough time to really study it in depth, but we did have some time and I did spend some time with it. And one wonders how many of these numerous copies that are printed at taxpayers' expense ever actually get read. Nevertheless, that's just a comment. I'll just move through the presentation first and then I'll get back to the report. Slide 3, I'm very happy to see the comments about the not sufficient underpinning by growth in the production sector. And I was wondering whether DTI are at all trying to influence municipalities, because my experience of municipalities is that they celebrate the construction of a shopping mall and all sorts of commercial activities, and very little production activity happens, and it's really quite serious. I mean, I take my own town, Ladysmith. There are two new shopping malls which are being celebrated, but not a single production facility. So I'd be interested in that. Chairman, throughout the presentation, so I'm not able to give you slide numbers, but the, there's talk of the motor industry and the incentives that are in place for that industry. Now, what is the DTI's view in terms of what is sometimes called sunset clauses for these incentives? These incentives, as I understand it, have been in place for 20 or more years. They cost the taxpayer huge amounts of money every year, and I'm not yet able to get to the bottom of how much these incentives actually cost the taxpayer, because the Minister hasn't quite answered my question in the way I wanted it answered. But in any of these incentives, surely there must be an end when this industry becomes self-sustained. If that's not going to be the case, then let's dump them and spend the money on something that can be self-sustainable. The quote, I'm intrigued, and I think you saw me look at you with a funny look when you said that the rand is the most volatile currency of developing currencies. In developing, I think that was the quote. I'm surprised because I thought it was quite stable. It's just getting stronger and stronger, but I don't see it doing this. But perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe my definition of volatility is incorrect. So if you could just help me with that one. I do now refer to a particular slide. Slide 8, I just need some help with the percentages there because on the one, I think even in the same, under employment performance, employment declined by 3%, the first bullet point, and after increasing by 3% in 2009, after increasing by 2.9% in 2009. I'm not sure I understand that. It's probably just a quick answer. You made the comment very quickly and glibly about intervening to get private financial sector releases of resources. What exactly are you and the DTI proposing here? It's very easy to make that comment, but what exactly is the banking sector going to get expect from you? The question of job losses, the Honourable Nyambi talked about, so I won't go into that. The BPO, your new kind of initiative, why are you getting involved in something that should be handled by the Department of Higher Education and Training, or do I not understand that new, training is not your function as far as I know. You're encouraging charcoal plants. Now, charcoal plants are huge polluters. How are you going to mitigate that? I mean, they create. I mean, we as a resident, we've made sure that a charcoal plant next to near us has been shut down because of the huge pollution it does. Charcoal. That's slide 16. Then, in terms of slide 17. I think you're absolutely spot on with the reference to biofuels, but we know that there's a huge amount of controversy regarding biofuels, the source material and food production. And we know that we've got a huge excess crop of maize for the current year. Are you involved in trying to change the mindset about using maize for that? Regulation of exports of scrap metal. We don't like regulation as a rule, but I'd love to know what kind of regulation you're talking about. And what I think more important is the importation of steel. The Eskom are building a new peaking power station in KwaZulu-Natal near Ladysmith, and they're sourcing huge amounts of steel from externally. They're buying it through a local agent, so they're able to claim that it's local, but the agent is importing the stuff. And yet we produce steel here, and there's some controversy around that. What I'm trying to say is export of scrap is an issue, perhaps I'm not so sure that it is, but far more important is the importation of high-grade steel, which we, Arkinlaw Metal should be, and I believe is able to produce in Newcastle. The motor industry, the AIS program, have any requirements in terms of green economy being built into that program? I probably should have read it by now myself and shouldn't be asking you the question, but I'm taking the opportunity to perhaps to abuse you in that regard. I'm curious about the TV and film industry. I mean, Cape Town, I think, is becoming a kind of South African center for that industry, although some very interesting films have been made in my province as well. The question really is that we providing incentives for the industry. How much of the revenue from the product comes back into South Africa? Does it not then just flow into other economies around the world, particularly the United States? The IDZs, the jury's out, in my opinion, about the IDZs. You've had IDZs around for years and years. The take-up is very limited, and yet we're still trying to push them without, I don't think, too much innovation to try and maybe I'm wrong, you can tell me if there are innovations that, which are going to encourage people to go there now as when they weren't going there years ago during a period when we had unprecedented growth in the country. Let's forget about the last 2 years. The slide 25, I think, refers to work done with other countries. Two countries which are emerging very rapidly are Bangladesh and Vietnam, and they're having a huge impact on our textile industry. Are we working with them at all? Slide 26, although it's probably not necessary to refer to a slide, the Romania, I think, is mentioned there. Is there any initiative on your part to switch the gateway to Europe from Rotterdam to Romania? I think it's the Danube River. It goes right up into Central Europe. It's a much shorter route for us, for our exports to Europe. And I think the cost of trading through Romania, which is an emerging economy, would be much less than Netherlands or Holland. I'm interested in the Italian arbitration case. The case was withdrawn, and yet you say it was an outcome in South Africa's favor. Well, it wasn't tested in court, if what I'm hearing you is true. It was simply withdrawn, so we don't yet know how the court may or may not have ruled. We have to assume that because they withdrew, they thought they were going to lose, but perhaps the political pressure was brought to bear on them. I don't know, but I don't know whether you can actually answer that because you're not the court. I think that Honourable Gunda made a very good point about access to incentives, especially small exporters. I'm not sure that the DTI is doing enough to make the incentives known throughout the country. And I know it's a huge task, but I think it's an important one. Your payment within 30 days is very noble, but it saddens me that it's just for certain suppliers. I mean, 30 days should be payment for all suppliers, no matter who they are, big or small. There should be no one has to wait with more than 30 days. Yeah, the jury's out with co-ops. Our view is that co-ops have been a dismal failure, and I think you'll acknowledge that. 5,000 or more co-ops formed over the last 10 years or something, and so the failure rate is huge. Perhaps they should just be dumped. Trying to get people to work together on projects that we think will be successful just cannot replace the entrepreneurial spirit of individuals. The Technogirl project for schools. I trust that it's not just targeting girls. I mean, are we not discriminating against these young boy, school boys because they happen to be a particular sex? And not, is there no similar program for them? Lottery distribution was mentioned earlier. You've talked about intervention there. I'd be interested to know what kind of intervention. There's so many NGOs out there that have collapsed because of a lack of funding and stopped funding and all sorts of implications. And it's really been had a serious impact on the needy. I'm curious that you've had to do research about whether advertising has an impact on liquor sales and gambling. I can assure you that SA Breweries will not advertise if they don't get any return for it. I don't think any research is needed. So I think that there's definitely, I'm just curious that we've had to do research about something that the private companies do. They don't spend money if they don't get a return. So I'm curious. Your unqualified audit is really commendable, 5 years of it. But then there are a huge number of entities that respond to you. My understanding is that there are many there that haven't got unqualified audits, and not least of which is CIPRA. There's no mention in your report about the problems you guys have had at CIPRA. And I would have thought that was something we needed more information on. It's really been an embarrassment, I think, to your department and to us as a country, and has had really serious impact on economic growth. I mean, I know that when I want to get onto the website, I've got to try and get on at midnight on Sunday or something, because if I try on a normal working day, you're likely to get bombed out. It's really just it's a frightening situation.
Chair, if I may, I will deal with the CIPRO, but I want to just correct one thing.
Yes, please do. Yeah,
the CIPRO also had an unqualified report.
My information is wrong. Mr. Chairman, let me just quickly go to the report then. Could I just get some information on page 223? I hope I've got the right page now. Note 10, unauthorized expenditure. There's an opening balance and a similar closing balance. So the whole year went by. I'm talking about the past financial year. Why have we not resolved this 37.38 million unauthorized expenditure? Why is it a carried forward amount? I would have thought we could resolve it in the year under consideration. And then page, coincidentally, similar numbers, 233, note 23, the contingent liabilities of 4.4 billion. There is note 3B, which gives some detail, which is on page 264. And in that detail, I'm curious of, 233, and then in the note to the note 23, which is annex 3B, can we have some explanation of the Fon Abbo 97 million, and then the ICSID of 2.8 billion? Now there are some notes at the bottom there, but could we just get a little bit more detail about those amounts on page 264, Young? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's me done.
You got that, did you? Page 264, you'll find the notes.
The more detailed explanation on the fund over amount of 97 million, I think it was, and the ICSID amount of 2.8 billion.
Honorable Sinclair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just thinking when the Honorable Gunda was so long-winded, I thought that now that he's been taken up by the DA, he doesn't get a lot of opportunity to speak. So maybe that's why he used his opportunity now when he's here.
Now, but he represents the Northern Cape and he represents you.
Okay. Yeah. No, but... yeah, fortunately, there's still a number of questions regarding the Northern Cape outstanding, so I'll deal with that. Che, can I start to say that to the DG and the team, yeah, I think they're one of the more effective departments and doing a good job. But certainly, the DG told us the thing that he wanted to tell us, but in the fineness between the lines, you know, there's many issues that one can raise, and certainly in terms of the annual report, I'm going to do that. But may I start out with a generic remark to say that I think one of the shortfalls of the implementation of a broader strategy is the lack of a national developmental framework for our country. And I think you would remember my old song and dance about the skewed developmental patterns in South Africa. And now a year later, it seems that that pattern is still continuing. And, you know, I plead from a Northern Cape perspective once again, look at the whole country, including the Northern Cape. If we really want to address the issues of poverty in our country, we mustn't make Gauteng richer. We must make the rest of South Africa richer and not allow a situation where 45% of the economy of this country has been generated in Gauteng. But coming then to the annual report, and I've got about 8 or 9 points that I just want to raise. If you look in the report on page 37, in terms of the transfer payments, there's quite a number of big amounts. The first one that I want to raise is the almost 860 million rand to KUGA. Now, I don't know, but more and more I get a suspicion that KUGA has become a very, very, very expensive pet hobby of government. And we at some stage certainly must ask the question, is it worthwhile to spend all that money? What is the benefits for the economy in terms of returns and so on? Then also on that page 37, there is a other. You know, now whenever I see other, I get a bit concerned. And it speaks about other critical infrastructure program, 105 million rand. What is that 105? And if I can link my question to the World Cup, did the DTI contribute any funds to the Soccer World Cup? Then, going to the next page 39, we've been to the DTI campus. We understand that there's some arrangement regarding the management of that facility and so on. So I see there, in terms of maintenance, the 25-year contract with Rainprop. What is the detail of that contractual obligations? Can you just maybe explain, and if you can't do it now, maybe come back to us regarding the value of that transaction, who is the owner? I think there's some contractual obligations to the municipality of Tshwane and so on and so forth. So maybe just lead us a bit on that. And then, if I can just step back to one page, 38, I see there's earmarked funds. Now, earlier there's a payment of almost 410 million to CEDA, but in terms of earmarked funds, there's another 333 million. So in total, it's almost 750 million going to CEDA. Is this in this financial year, this earmarked funds, or is it rollovers for the next financial year? Then, if I can jump to page 94. In terms of building our international image, it's necessary that, you know, we have got a broad spectrum of economic counselors. Now, what I picked up in this complete list, there's about 10 vacancies for economic counselors. Certainly, those people must be in the forefront of marketing and promoting South Africa's economic possibilities. What is the reason for so many vacancies in terms of economic counselors? Then, if I can then go to page 264. The statement of the contingent liabilities. Now, there's quite a big outstanding amount. Now, we know it's claims, and it's almost 3.4 billion rand. But the one that's standing out there is third from the bottom, ICSID. What is that about? That's almost 2.8 billion rand. What is that claim for? And if I can just check page, just the page before that, 263, there's a number of guarantees that has been provided by DTI, or I suppose National Treasury. It's once again almost 950 million rand, which is a lot of money. That KFW, what company is that? And what's it for? If you can just maybe elaborate on those guarantees that's been provided for those four entities. And the last issue that I want to raise, before I do that, can I just say I share the concern of Honorable Lees regarding CPRO. I think with due respect, Mr. DG, you just told us a nice story, but, I mean, try and do business with CPRO these days, it's a nightmare. And that's hampering economic growth in this country. So what is the situation with CPRO? The last word that I've got is the one about trade and investment delegations. Now, you were boasting about the big delegation that went to China and so on, 300 plus, and so it's very nice. But it seems that there's a tendency that you must be politically connected to be part of those delegations. Am I right or am I wrong? There's a structure, there were some issues in the media about that, called the Progressive Business Forum. And the business people say if you don't belong to the Progressive Business Forum and pay your dues, you don't get the opportunity to go on these investment opportunities. Certainly, business must be independent and do what they're supposed to do, and that is to do business. Correct me if I'm wrong. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Sinclair, Honorable Dihale.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. On slide number 34, in our rural area, for the ladies to qualify for even the Women's Fund, they need to register the CC first, and money is a problem. I don't know whether the department can come up with a plan whereby they can just be helped without popping out money. And the other one is on slide 44. There was a campaign on liquor was launched by the minister in Bloemfontein and etc. So there is also a problem in our rural area with the liquor. The people who are selling liquor, they close late at 2 o'clock. And the learners will just dance throughout. And at the end of the year, we expect a good result, of which they don't end up having them. And it's a problem because now our youth are leaders even in their homes, in their families. So I don't know, how can we change this regulation so that those who are selling liquor, maybe they can do it earlier. Thanks.
Thanks, Hoshi. Let me add my voice in appreciating the report of the Auditor General. But under normal circumstances, if the report is good, it is good, you know, irrespective of what the Auditor General has raised on other matters. But it is good. I think we should give credit where it is due. You know, the department has done well, which is fine, but we'll take the department up on other issues. One issue that has been raised by two other members is the issue of these visits by business people. I've also received a letter, I don't know whether it is of complaint or concern. Some business persons have written to me trying to check the criteria, you know, or the system that is being used in choosing this business. I've interacted with BUSA, and so on. But on the part of the department, I haven't interacted with somebody because I understand the department also sends certain business people. So it's an issue that we need to look at, more especially from SMME's side. It shouldn't be like mining where you see, even in these streets, the usual suspects, now from mining to trade. So it's an issue that we need to look at. The other issues that have been raised by the Auditor General, we just get the feedback, what has been an outcome, because there might have been a change from April up to now. The issue of irregular expenditure, the approval of the organizational structure, the issue of leadership raised by the AG. So we'll just get a progress report. I am aware about the World Cup issue, that it's a matter that should come on this financial year. I'm sure we didn't expect the DG to talk much about it because this was up to 30 March. But more especially the World Cup and the CIPRO issue are issues that will be reported next year. But it will be no harm if the DG just gives some clarification on those issues. Some issues, and we're really going to be strong on them, more especially the ITZ issues. You know, since they were established in 2002, we have seen, you know, we come from provinces, that there's been too much concentration on the Eastern Cape. There's Kuka, there's East London, you know what? Yeah, even with the financing. Now, with total disregard of other areas, and at one stage I did write a letter to the minister, the same with the deputy minister of public enterprises, because in KwaZulu-Natal we've got an issue with the container terminal and the harbour, and it doesn't feature on Transnet's plan for the next 20 to 30 years. So we'll end up writing a letter to the presidency whether this issue was a political decision or what. But there's nothing that really shows that there is an interest in moving forward with the ITs, more especially in KwaZulu-Natal. But I've also taken up the issue with the Minister of Economic Development. But it is a major concern. The other issue is the EPA with the EU and challenges with SACU members. What's the way forward? Because you cannot be meeting SACU and then other things are being done when you have to deal with the ITA. One member that we had here last time in the previous parliament, I'm sure I'll send him this report, that there's an agreement that has been signed with regards to cheese. He always complained about the cheese when it was to go to the EU. He's in Limpopo, former member Honorable Sbia. So I'll send him a report that now there's an agreement. The cheese from South Africa can now go to the EU countries. In China, that's another point. Most of China's GDP comes from SMMEs. And that is why I went to China in July. And they've got major and strong and good support from government and departments, not the real big companies. What can we learn from the South Africa? Or do we need the human numbers to behave like China? What can we do in order for us to strengthen the SMMEs? Another issue would be the implementation of the rectified agreements that deal with trade. So that's one issue of concern that I have. I attended PAP last week, and quite a number of agreements. Others are just lying fallow. I've asked for these agreements from international relations, but one, those that deal with trade. How far are we, you know, tracking the implementation of those agreements? Now, in this issue with regards to SICPRO, a new crime has come up, the one of hijacking of companies. I also wrote an official letter to the department. Someone wrote to me, check, he found out he's no longer a member of a company. And I wrote a letter, they responded positively. Then they hinted out that, you know, people could do with this and that, but the department is acting. So what's the plan now in trying to stop this hijacking of companies? I'm sure you'll just give a clarification, even though maybe it might go to about the CITO IT tender for report for next year, but you'll just give some clarification. I won't comment on people with disabilities because I'll target it specifically sometime and get the areas and levels of these people where they are located. But where I will come strongly is also on the issue of consultants. I've checked that there were 7 in July, 5 in October, 8 in June, 3 in August, 3 in September, 9 in November, and 34 in total at a cost of 23. I'm afraid to say million. I'm afraid to say billion. I might as well say million. That's very huge. That's really, you know, huge. It's millions. That's very huge, 23 million. For just that short space of time, why on this particular month, you know? And the issue that was raised by Honorable Nyambi, that you would see some of them almost doing the same amounts. The other issue that is confronting us, I wanted to ask it in the Economic Development Committee yesterday, is the issue of fronting whilst we still are trying to assist SMMEs in procuring goods. I didn't write a note. I thought Honorable Nyambi would have asked it yesterday, that on our provincial visit to KwaZulu-Natal, we visited some housing projects of about 23 million and 350 million, two different houses. It was said the owner was a female, a lady, was owning the company, but certain whites were with her and saying, now she owns, she's the boss. But when we left the briefings, the lady was asking for a lift home. And to me, that was the first sign that this company did not belong to this lady. You can't ask for a lift when there were two projects of 700 million. So how are we going to tackle it? Do you have a plan on how are we really going to tackle it? Lastly, I want to appreciate the presence of Mr. Zikota when we had the workshop with financial institutions. We also called NEF. And IDC, we lost out on the DBSA. Because from our experience in China, we're not happy with the acquisitions of the shares of Standard Bank by ICBC. We wanted to understand how was that taking South Africa further in Africa and in the world. To our amazement in China, we found that Standard Bank, that was our conclusion, was just being used to colonize Africa, to get the work in Africa, because the prerequisite is that if Standard Bank gets the work, they'll give the finance, they'll bring the contract to the particular country. So we decided to have this workshop, say financial institutions, how far are you helping Africa, South Africans and Africans doing business among its own. So all the financial institutions were there, and some of the DFIs were there from South Africa. We'll have a second round. We'll invite the department because we want to have a clear program. Because we want South Africa and SADC to trade within now. We've got too much resources that we can rely on Europe and the North. Thank you very much. DG? What did you follow up?
I haven't asked anything.
Oh, I did. Because you didn't indicate that you wanted to ask. Honorable Van Lingen.
Honorable Chair, when Cope was speaking, I tried to catch your eye.
And he
was not coping even with my friend in the Northern Cape. And you, anyway, that's besides the point. I'm a little bit worried, and I have to agree with my colleague about the rand and so on. My big concern with the Department of Trade and Industry is, what role do you actually play in protecting or working through, not protecting, establishing a safe clothing industry in South Africa, and when I mean safe, I actually mean sustainable. Business need to be sustainable. And the role that labor plays in it and the rand. And who makes money out of this the most? In other words, what are the threats to the industries that are most threatened and create the most jobs in South Africa? You understand? So I'm not saying you are passing the blame, but I'm so worried. In South Africa, it's such an easy thing. We must just, I would like to know how you feel about it. What is the risk assessment of that situation? Then on slide 14, you refer in the last bullet that you've developed a criteria for new large electricity connections. I need to know where I can find the details of that. What progress have you made with the Mthatha 20 million rand furniture project? Then scrap metal in South Africa. We know that scrap metal is actually sold off overseas at the port like you can't believe it. Why can't we do something about that and change it in South Africa and add the value here? I can't find the slide now, but it goes about the IDZ, and I don't know if I've gone far enough. Oh, I found it. No, I haven't got it yet. Kucha has got a lot, and I'm not sure we're really making progress with Kucha. And then what happened to the Dube trade port? Did the IDT not work with them, and what was invested there? And then you talk about the number of people that you have dismissed for irregularities and what have you, and I can't find that slide. Here it is, 48. How many cases of fraud and corruption in each subsection of what offence, for what amount, and what outcome of disciplinary hearing? You know, the whole process where they are found guilty, are they then, in other words, do you, the department, allow the disciplinary hearing process to get to the very end? Because it costs a legal advice to get that far. Once you got there and that person is guilty, do you then agree a settlement with him, or do you dismiss him or her for that matter? And then once that individual is dismissed, in how many cases have you laid criminal charges against the individuals? Because that is the most important thing. And then in slide 31 and slide 54, you talk about 183 new small exporters were assisted to promote their products in, blah, 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 blah. Does that talk to the slide 31? And if so, are we having a success there, or is it just development and projects on paper? Slide 31, and then your one on 54. And what is the Western Cape's figures there? I can't read over the double print there. Thank you. I can see that.
Yeah, I'm sorry on the phone, Ling, and that I didn't catch your eyes. Pardon. Okay. Must try another hour. The last question for me would be the issue of Taiwan, DG. We've got no trade agreements, political agreements, but there are groups from Taiwan that are flocking the country. What's the issue on that?
Thank you very much, honorable member, for a wide-ranging number of questions, some that are easy, some that are difficult, but I do have a big team here that is going to assist. So what I will do is I will deal with some of these questions, because in a sense the questions are self-selecting. And all questions related with industrial policy, trade, exports, and so on will be dealt with between Nimrod and Sadiq from TISA. HR-related questions around vacancies, performance agreements, so on. Where's Sarah? Is that out? You know, Sarah will deal with the DCG for group services. And then DDG duly will deal with questions around the regulation, lotteries, maybe CIPRO, to some extent. Rodo will say something about CIPRO, and so on and so forth. I think the questions will be well covered amongst us. I think that I'll deal with perhaps more the more overarching sort of issues. I think the questions around, for example, Northern Cape, where Northern Cape features, how Northern Cape features in our work, and I'm using Northern Cape really as a proxy, I guess, for underdeveloped rural provinces, where that features in our work is linked to the question that Honorable Sinclair raised about the lack of a framework for our country. Because I think that the spatial disparities in economic development is a core economic development challenge that we confront and have to feature in a very explicit way, I think. I concede that it hasn't. It has not featured in a way that enables us to actually see the spatial economy, see these, you know, disparities on our radar screen permanently, constantly on our radar screen, so that really, I think, in terms of measuring what we do, we can also be measured on that dimension. Because it's so important. So I concede that there is a major
policy gap in regard to how we deal with the spatial economy. And that although we are doing some things, other departments are doing some things, I know that COCTA, you know, are also doing some things and so on. There is a lack of an integrated sort of framework. And I think that in regard to responding to that, the work that the department is doing, plus the Department of Economic Development, this new growth path, and I'm sure yesterday they would have raised the growth path, they foreground that issue. They do foreground that issue, and I think that there must be, we must focus in that area to build on what we are doing, pull all of these things together in some ways. Because as I observed, the sector work, some of these sectors, if you look at forestry, for example, furniture and so on, have a very clear regional spatial dimension. Because it's certain provinces. Forestry belongs to certain provinces. And they happen to be poor provinces. Eastern Cape, you know, Mpumalanga, and so on. So if we take we build sort of a matrix. We take sectors and we say where are they located, and then when we know that they're located in particular provinces, we then say, as far as these sector projects are concerned, we're gonna tighten our cooperation with the provinces, and we work together with the provinces. We work together with the municipalities. So there are conceptual policy issues that need to be tackled, as well as institutional coordination issues that need to be tackled. Because even where sometimes we see that there are possibilities in a particular sector to support particular provinces, we find that maybe the province doesn't quite believe that, or it's not a focus of the province, or the municipality is not really paying attention to that. And I think what this actually underscores is the fact that economic development is a complex exercise. And there is a thing that DTI can do, but I think that it seems to me that it's really about how all the tiers of government coordinate around economic development. And again, there I think that we have some way to go to bring all our plans, because we are all planning. You know, there are many silos. There are many silos at a national level. I'll give you an example. Forestry cannot grow without water, and we for years have not been able to find each other with the department responsible for that. We have been able to find ourselves with another department, and somebody made reference to BPO and the skills elements of BPO. We found each other with the Department of Higher Education. And here's what they say to us. They say, you know, when it comes to skills, our work on skills, we find that our outcomes are much more stronger. We achieve a lot more if we locate within your sector strategies. So when you are tackling skills in the context of a sector strategy, the results are much more mature than if you do generic things and whatever. So the BPO is a partnership where we've asked them. In fact, it's here because we're working together. And at the end of the day, we are the accounting department for progress on BPO. So they come in there. So it's a partnership. It's a good model, and we're looking at doing it in other sectors, as it were. But here is, we have a concrete, tangible
process. It's not like, you know, higher education, you have a dispensation around skills and we go there and tap. Because when we try that over the years, it hasn't quite worked. Behind us are potential investors who say, bring on the kids, we will take them. So the nice model which we hope to develop from. So we found each other with the department that advances our work. But there are others where we are struggling, and I'm sure Nimrod will speak to this perhaps a little bit more in a more focused way. But I concede that all of this makes it difficult to measure the impact we're having on much more even economic development and a reasonable spread of economic development, which does not quite correspond to the potential and capacities that exist, because in some instances there are issues of capacity. With regard to municipalities, I want to make one observation, because somebody else also raised the issue of municipalities and supermarkets. I went to address a conference of mayors and municipal executives, and they put me under a tight critical spotlight. So they say, what is DCI doing? These malls are popping up all over the place, killing what you call it. And I said to them, I said, well, in fact, in truth, is that we don't license the municipality's license. You license all the businesses that come in. Why don't you put conditions on the license? Why don't you say it's required to come, but you are not going to kill these local people, work with them, source from them, partner with them, so that they can integrate in the supply chain, as it were. And you can develop them. We can come in with our instruments. We've got business supply development. So we can support, enhance the capacity of these people to supply to your requirements, but work with them. They never thought about that. So they willingly license these malls, and then expect DCI to do something about the businesses that die. So it seems to me that again in that space, you know, we need an approach to integrated conceptual sort of approach to how we develop localities and regions. I think the point is well taken. I want to deal with some of the policy issues around IDZ, because in some ways I think IDZ are part of that sort of issue. We saw in IDZ the possibility that we can deconcentrate economic activity in certain provinces. To say that, I think the concerns are well taken, because I think that we need policy consensus that we, notwithstanding the huge resources that are being consumed by these IDZs, that we are going to stay the course. Because, by the way, in some instances we've gone far down the line in sinking in resources to can simply just walk away like that. We need a policy consensus. It's not there. And so, you know, we with regard to IDZs, we are, to use a phrase, we are half pregnant, and it's a very uncomfortable space to be in.
So, we find that every year the Treasury also is awkward because they know that these things need resources. They believe that there is some value in the IDZ program. But in absent a firm, clear policy commitment, they are not. So they don't really go all the way in funding these things. So they give us some money, but it's not sustainable. And that creates a catch-22 situation because potential investors, they're watching. They're watching the commitment, how strong it is, and the performance. And where they feel that the government as a whole is not too committed to this thing, they won't come. They won't come. Whereas, if there's anything to learn about China, is that they have gone in because they believe in it. They put in the resources. Whether investors come or not, they put in the resources. And if you look at these initiatives in China, you will see that at some point they begin to turn around. But you've got to take a long-term thing. So we feel that benchmarking what we're doing, we're not way out of line in regard to the duration that it takes for these things to ultimately take off. They don't come buzzing with a TVC overnight. But it's a long-term commitment and so on. So we need to tackle those issues based on the experience that we have and then find sustainable funding model. Because I think the policy is correct. And we've seen that there's a steady growth, in the investor. Kuka, as my minister said to me the other day, we're talking about this, is, well, it does. We went into it with particular assumptions which don't hold anymore. We thought there would be an anchor investor. And if you recall, it was going to be the aluminium smelter that now never came to be. So we've got to review the model for Guha and then the funding. So all of those things are important policy issues, and we are undertaking work around further policy development around the IDZs and so on. And I think that when we have developed at least the basic policy document, we will come back and engage with yourselves, because I'm sure you can make a useful contribution in that regard. And that's really in as far as IDZs are concerned. I think in regard to overall development framework that speaks to the spatial economy, again, I think that there's work that needs to be done. We have started to do a little bit of work for our own in DTI. The Economic Development Department is also looking at that space. So I think that there is scope, I think, for us to develop strong, clear policy responses to the challenges that have been raised. The job losses, I think that the job losses that we reflected to a very, very large extent as a result of the recession. Because prior to those job losses, the economy and manufacturing performance was beginning to create jobs on a steady but consistent level. And with the recession, many companies shed jobs. Hence, in fact, it was what was once, if you remember, the newspapers, calling it the jobs bloodbath, is what actually
provoked this response to the global economic crisis framework response, where we brought the IDC and so on. So one of those jobs, you know, have to do with that. Because I think that what that meant is that where we were beginning to see a turnaround in job losses associated with deindustrialization, and we began to turn around, I think what the recession did was to set us back, and they set us back. The recession has set us back quite significantly. None of us can say with any certainty how we will recover those jobs. But our strategic objectives refer to employment creation. And contrary to people saying that we pay lip service to this, but in fact, actually, you don't get an incentive support from a TTI if one of the criteria we look at, job creation, you don't meet it. So the criteria, some of the sort of consistent criteria for our incentives will include things like jobs, will include things like, are you going to set up in an underdeveloped region, province? Will include things like, are you going to promote equity and empowerment, and so on. So we have a range of criteria, the purpose of which is to make an impact, to alter the structure of the economy, and so on. Talking about automotives and going green, clearly the investment incentive, which I'm sure Nimrod might also want to talk to, says when you introduce new technologies and all automotive manufacturers have embraced energy efficiency, have embraced green, the imperative of the green economy and climate change. So if you innovate as a manufacturer in that space, you get additional points. Because we are clear that we don't want, when the rest of the world is moving green, we remain with dirty technologies here in our country. We've got to align with trends, global trends in regard to that. Now, having said that, I think that there is still scope for us to align our incentives a lot more with previously disadvantaged people and BEE. And in regard to BEE, we want to be able to say, not when you offer equity to some group of individuals, but we want to say when you procure from enterprises, and therefore promote enterprise development, when you skill people, and so on, the broad-based elements of this thing. I think the scope, we have been looking at this and say we now need our BEE policy and programs and industrial policy to speak to each other in ways that they do not currently. So that's another next level in which we are going to move our policies. My colleagues will speak to the BEE, the equity equivalents, around BEE, what they are and that type of thing, and how it actually works. Now,
before you continue, please, you know, last time we had a meeting, we started at 10, and for this meeting we decided to start at 9:30, because we always run short of time. So next time I'm sure we'll start at about 8. So that we have enough time, all of us, we engage too much. I think we have got about 40 minutes now, so that we engage properly.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to speak for too long, because I'm making much more of cross-cutting, you know, generic points. My colleagues will speak to the specifics.
And perhaps let me speak. Let me deal with the three key issues. And then the first set of questions that were asked by the honourable member were really about how we integrate previously disadvantaged people in our work. And I think part of the answer to that question is that we have that division led by Sipho Zikode, the empowerment and the enterprise, is dedicated specifically to that issue. Because what we were doing previously, locating the work on industrial development, which is huge portfolio in itself, and the work on empowerment and enterprise development in one place. So we had this huge division trying to tackle, if you like, the two economies from the same space, and we were struggling with either. So we split the division, and the intention was to create a special focus on empowerment and the linkages between these two economies, because we have no hope of developing the second economy if the first economy is not growing. The first economy has to grow, and when it does that, it has to pull the second economy, and that is a challenge. But of course, we also recognize that not everybody in the second economy is going to migrate or has the opportunity to be pulled by the first economy, because the first economy, by its very nature, requires certain capacity, certain skills, and that type of thing. But and then therefore, some people will have to be supported where they are. And I think in that space, cooperatives and so on, and some of our enterprise development initiatives will speak to that. So we are satisfied that we do take account the previously disadvantaged people to the extent that we can. But the reality also is that in certain sectors of our economy, the industrial manufacturing sector, for example, what we found is that typically there are no black people. And I'm exaggerating to make the point, because I'm sure there are black people who manufacture, but the mainstream manufacturing economy, there are no black people. When we meet with the CEOs and industrialists, it's all white, male for that matter. So clearly the manufacturing sector has to transform. And I think that BEE has to promote manufacturing. BEE can't just promote acquisition of shares where black people have shares, but they actually don't run the economy. So the manufacturing investment program, has to help us address that challenge. The small exporters, are they properly capacitated? We do not take anybody who has absolutely no hope of making it in the international market. So the small exporter development program is a step by step. You have to complete all of the steps before we take you abroad. Because we know sometimes you take people at an expense, and they actually cannot, they cannot make it. But Sadiq will give a sense of what the outcomes are, what the performance are. There are some real successes in regard to that. I want to deal with the matter of Cipro. I think that there are two dimensions to the Cipro issue. There are real issues around weaknesses various sorts of administrative weaknesses that have been identified, but that we are dealing with. So yes, I'd like to assure all of you who have raised the issue of CIPRO that from right to the top of the department, the leadership of the minister, through the relevant officials, we are seized with the matter of CIPRO because we recognize the threat that it poses to our work and to the economy in general. I do have to say that some of the challenges in regard to CIPRO require that the law enforcement authorities of the country, and that means the police need to work with us very closely. We do not feel that the police have discharged themselves with the kind of diligence that the challenge of CIPRO demands, as it were. So the matter is under control, and I think that we do not expect that there should be any further lapses of security and control that have resulted in some of the things that have emerged. And relative to the databases of CIPRO, which has millions of companies, the problems are quite contained. It's not like there's massive hijackings going on there at CIPRO. But the fact that there are problems and we're dealing with them is one side. The other side of this is the perception, public perceptions, and so on. And I think, in regard to that, we are challenged, because the public, the reporting, has been such as to portray the problem as if there is a complete failure of that function. So yes, there are challenges. We're working on them, but unfortunately, you know, in the dimension of PR and what you call it, I think that we are on our back foot. And so part of the work that we need to do is to actually win back the confidence of the public that the problems are being addressed, that function works at the best of times, and that in any case, we're already on our way towards modernization of the function as a result of the Companies Act, which says that function will be overhauled and located in a different entity, agency, which we are quite advanced towards establishing. And in the context of that, there are certain things that we're doing. We're cleansing the data with the assistance of the SSA. We're cleansing the data, making sure that everybody's got an address and so on. Every company in there can be traced back to an individual with an ID, with an address, and so on. All of that work is going on, because we recognize that you don't want to take the rot that has developed in CIPRO into a new entity. So we have to make a clean break with the past, and we are doing that. So the matter of CIPRO is under control. We will have an opportunity to discuss this further, because I am sure that we will have to come back. Ultimately, our success is going to depend on sorting out the IT challenges. And the ECM tender, by the way, was meant to do precisely that, but that's on hold because of the action that we've taken when we discovered the tender was corrupted. We've had to stop it. But our intention is to overcome that, and we're in the courts. We've asked for the courts to allow us, in the interest of continuing the public service, to get
to move on with the technology, so the IT part of this. So it's work in progress, and we are confident that we will overcome the challenges of CIPRO. We will put in new management, new leadership that can help sort out and restore that function to its proper place. It's a pity that something like CIPRO, which is one out of the dozen or so entities, yes, acknowledging that it does what you call it, an important service, should overshadow the work of the department in the way that it has. But I want to assure you that we will not allow CIPRO to take away from the good work that has been done in the department. We will deal with it decisively, and I'm confident we will overcome the challenges of CIPRO.
The minutes are getting fewer.
I'm now handing over to my Nimrod, I think perhaps you want to start.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan,
I think as part of the strategic imperatives, the department must go for a time management course, you know, because time on time we're running out of time. Can I request that the questions that I ask and that I deem urgent be responded in writing? Because I would ask you to excuse me now. Thank you.
Nimrod.
Thank you, honourable members and DG. I think I'll try and move as rapidly as possible. I've tried to group the questions because I think in some cases they overlap across different sectors. There were a couple of questions asked in relation to the clothing and textile sector. I think the first was, you know, what is our general approach and how does this interact with the main challenges that the industry faces? Our approach is really based on the fact that we have, you know, said quite clearly we cannot compete with countries like China and Vietnam and Bangladesh on the basis of as poor working conditions and labor conditions as possible. We can't compete on the basis of a race to the bottom in terms of those working conditions. And I think even China is beginning to, you know, to shift in this respect and raise wages and improve working conditions. So the approach that we've taken is that we really need to focus on upgrading the competitiveness of the industry for it to be sustainable, and that means putting in place programs that will support, broadly speaking, upgrading with respect to products, processes, and people. And to that end, we've put in place the Clothing Textiles Competitiveness Program, which supports business plans put forward by the industry to upgrade in those three areas. It's also supported by a production incentive. Even though it's outside the ambit of the period being reported on, most of the preparatory work was done during the last financial year, but there have been about 99 companies approved so far under the scheme, and there are indications that this will lead to an increase in employment in the companies that are participating in the scheme. There are a whole, you know, about half again as many companies in the pipeline. Obviously, there are massive, massive challenges in this industry, and the two that I think that we would probably highlight the most is, first of all, it's the currency. I think it's absolutely clear. There's absolute consensus. The currency is completely overvalued on a real effective exchange rate basis. It's higher than it's been at any point since there's data available. In other words, since the beginning of 1990. So that is a massive challenge, and it relates partly to the labour and the wage question, because any particular wage in dollar terms is half at 10 rand to the dollar than what it would be at 5 rand to the dollar. So even wage rates are themselves very much a function of of the currency. The other very big issue, of course, is the illegal imports, and in particular under invoicing. There was a question, have we looked at China? Yes, we've looked very closely at China. You know, there's evidence to indicate that there's something of the order of under invoicing of a magnitude of about 60% from China. We're working very closely with SARS in order to clamp down on this under invoicing, and they've achieved some successes, but obviously there's a lot of a lot more that needs to be done in that area. Then there were a second set of questions that were raised around the auto industry. I think the one question was, really I think that the core of the question is, you know, should one support this industry, and, you know, is it an indefinite, uncritical kind of support that just never gets taken away? Let me just indicate that since 1995, when the current program started, MIDP, the size of the industry has doubled, production has doubled, capacity has doubled, in fact more than doubled, and we've seen a tenfold growth in exports in the industry as a consequence of the Motor Industry Development Program. Yes, the industry has received significant support under the MIDP, but it's important to bear in mind that the support has been scaling down continuously over time. So in the early 1990s, tariffs on vehicles were in the order of about 100%. These have come down now to currently to about 30%. And what that means is that every year the vehicle assemblers have to do more in order to achieve the same level of support. Now, what we also do is there's a regular review of all of our sector programs, including the auto program. And this was conducted, there was a very extensive review that was conducted of the MIDP. This led us to conclude that although there were significant successes, there were some shifts that we had to make. The first is that we needed to move from an export kind of led or based program to a production-based program, partly because there was a potential World Trade Organization compatibility issue around an export-led program. Secondly, because we also realized there needs to be more balance in terms of the growing domestic market, servicing the growing domestic market as well as the export market. There are also measures in place in the new APDP to ensure greater efforts, competitiveness raising. This includes setting minimum volume thresholds. So what we're pushing for now are two main things. One is higher levels of higher economies of scale by saying that you must have a minimum production of 50,000 vehicles per annum, but also high levels of localization in the component sector. And this is where we really think that jobs can come. So I think the other relevant point is that in the international context, there's no serious player. There are no players in the auto industry. There are no countries that have an auto industry that don't provide support to their auto industry. So that's the context in which, you know, we as a country have to compete for investments which can go to many different destinations. So I think the question for us is, what is a reasonable level of support that we can put in place to ensure that we attract this investment to South Africa? And we believe that we've struck that kind of balance. On a net economic basis, there are very, very significant net positive benefits to having an auto industry. It's an industry that really has the strongest multipliers and linkages with other sectors of the economy. So it pulls through inputs from everything from steel, from plastics, from leather, and it goes. It has all sorts of linkages through other sectors of the economy. We are very mindful of the shifts in technology towards greater green requirements. What we found is, at least with existing technologies, the assemblers and the manufacturers meet the latest emissions requirements and so forth, for the very simple reason that they're exporting a significant part of their production, and they're exporting into the most demanding markets, which have, you know, the highest prevailing emission standards. So we do meet the highest standards in the world, but we are also keeping a very close eye on the technological developments in the industry. So, for instance, we've set up an intra-departmental task team to work on, what is our approach to the introduction of electric vehicles into the South African market. We want to see, not that we don't just facilitate the import of electric vehicles, but that we ensure that we take a part of the production, that we're part of this new technological shift. On industrial financing, there's a task team that's been set up by comprising National Treasury, DTI, and Economic Development. It's too early to say, it isn't at the point where it's making specific recommendations, but what it has clearly identified is that there are a lot of market failures in extending finance to manufacturing in particular. And the most important of those market failures is that there's a mismatch between the source of funding for commercial banks, which is generally either deposits or short-term capital inflows, and their ability to extend long-term financing. So if you've got short-term sources of financing as a bank, and then it becomes difficult for you to extend long-term financing because you've got to match your sources to your outflows. And this has confirmed we've had a number of interactions with all the major, most of the major commercial banks. So, but this is ongoing work, and we will obviously come back and brief the committees on the outcome of this work. The restrictions on scrap exports we put in.
Can I find out if there is a way forward to can move on this issue? Because I know some officials and various some members are diabetic, and as soon as 1 o'clock ticks, it's programmed. Can I have some proposals? Hunda?
Honorable Chair, some of the questions they can write to us, give us in written, but I would like, and if it's possible, Chair, through you, if they can conclude in the next 15 minutes. Thank you, Chair. We've got another meeting at 2 o'clock.
Honorable Adams?
Some of us are not perfect, but you've just got other
Mazamban.
We won't miss him.
Mm-hmm.
We won't miss him.
Just try and be quicker, whoever is going to speak. Someone wrote me a note and said, we are going to sacrifice our lives. We hope the teacher is going to pay. And it wasn't planned. Can we move faster?
Chair, I suggest I wrap up on, I think the other major issue was the scrap exports. I suggest I wrap up on that and take the other inputs as comments on the sectoral issues. But just very briefly to say that we've done a very considerable amount of work on scrap exports as DTI. We believe that there's a very compelling reasons to put in place export duties on scrap. It's a national resource. Most other developing countries put in place these restrictions on scrap exports. It also embodies, there's a lot of energy embodied, so you're basically working against carbon emission objectives. But the proposal is sitting with National Treasury, and we really are, engaging with them to see, how we can find a way forward and conclude this matter.
Thank you, Chair. Mine will be very quick. On Honorable Kunda's question on the 17 municipalities that benefited from the LED program. Of those 17, Honorable Member, four were from the Northern Cape. I'm sure this is very good news for you. And those are Namakwa and District Municipality, Galagadi, Tixlikafeme, Francis Bard. On the issue of the 500 million equity equivalent program, the breakdown. In short, the equity equivalent program is a program where we allow multinationals that through their policies and rules, they don't allow to sell equity into the local people. So we allow them to invest into the local economy 25% of their South African operations. Well, to develop 25% of their South African operations. So the companies that have applied to our minister for exemption is Labour, Hansen, and Hewlett and Packard, HP. And Labour, over the 7 years, it will be investing into the local economy 18 million. Hansen, it will be investing 8 million. And the rest will be invested by HP over the 7 year period. So the total will be about 500 million. And these projects will be benefiting black people. And they are all in the ICT sector. So the programs include things like training, you know, skills development, all those things. Moving over to Honorable Avams about the disabled people who benefit from the co-ops programs. We have the, like the DG was saying, we have the co-ops investment scheme. Number three co-ops owned by the disabled people have benefited, and I'm sure my colleague from the enterprise development will concur to this. And CIPRO has been registering co-ops that are owned by disabled people this year. I think I've covered all the questions related to my division, but just to touch on the question asked by the chair, how do we support SMEs like China is doing? I think there is a huge effort by the department, together with the Department of Urban Planning, to strengthen the collaboration between government at all levels, because really the services and products that have been designed by government could only be delivered through the municipalities and through the organizations belonging to the state, with the partnership, starting a partnership with the private sector. But then the most important thing on the finance side, really, we also have to look at the risk averseness of the state, which is really reflected from the lending criteria that the DFIs and even commercial banks require for access to finance. Is it not time maybe to look at establishing something like the SME Bank, which is supported and guaranteed by the state? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members. I've got just three areas to cover. I think the one area which is as controversial, I think, as CIPRO, and which we've managed to curtail, was the issue of the lotto funds, the distribution thereof. You'll recall, Members, that last year the department did intervene in the National Lottery Board to assess what the causes of all of those concerns were. And in that process, the minister involved his counterparts, the Minister of Arts and Culture, Sports and Social Development, to try and come up with solutions, identify the challenges, come up with solutions, and we did have roundtables. And our minister created a working group, which I was leading, to try and identify and come up with action plans. And in that process, we identified a number of challenges, most of which were administrative. The systems that support the grant-making process was not good enough. And it was agreed that it needs to be revised, and they're working on that, and there's good progress in that. And then the other area was that the requirements for applicants were very high, such that a lot of NGOs, which are small and don't have capacity, are unable to meet those requirements upfront. So which means that the grant-making process was basically, putting deserving organizations outside. That has been addressed. One of the issues that that we introduced to address that, the minister issued regulations that removed some of the requirements, like the requirement for 2-year audited financial statements for NGOs. That was removed. So in that sense, there's a lot of now improvement in terms of access. But the other concern was the time it takes to pay, which was a problem that even when you've been granted, you can wait for 6 months to a year before you get payment. That is an administrative issue that has been addressed. But then, in addition to the administrative issues, there were other matters that we felt that require legislative intervention. So we are in the process of amending the Lotteries Act, and that process will be going to cabinet soon. The policy has been finalized, and we've got a draft bill that will be put into cabinet in the next few weeks. So I think in the report of the National Lotteries Board, you will be in the position to see, because we don't report on for them here, but you'll see those improvements in terms of turnaround times. You'll see that there's also activities to improve the system, because the process there is highly administrative, and the IT support is very crucial to fast-track the process. And we've also put in a new board, in the National Lotteries Board. The chairperson, Professor Nabutanda, is very focused on these issues, because he was sitting in the meetings with the minister as well. So we are implementing those things, and I'm sure that you'll see the results, I think, in a more impactful manner. The other area that I needed to respond to was the issue around the research on advertising. In fact, to the contrary, as government, we are told all the time that there is no impact at all. And because we are government, and when we propose regulation to strengthen certain areas, you need to support that with some kind of research that talks to your situation in South Africa. There's a lot of research that has been done, but you'll find that in some of the research that comes out, the companies will tell you that they don't advertise to increase consumption. They'll tell you they advertise to keep the people that are already on, you know, consuming. They say there's no impact whatsoever. And they just tell you it's brand promotion and stuff like that. But what you then need from a regulatory perspective, because you need research that will inform your policy formulation. You don't put policy, you don't put regulation until you have got a basis for it. So the research was commissioned to do that. And the result of that, you'll see recently that we've published, ministers issued regulations that are out there for comments in the gambling industry to try and curtail the level of advertising that is being put into gambling, and also the use of promotions, you know, to stimulate and overstimulate gambling. And so it is for that reason. Before you put in regulation, you must do your analysis very well. There must be a need for it, because we don't want to put regulations that become a burden on business and people doing business in South Africa. So that was the reason we did that. And the last part that I needed to respond to, which I think the members will be happy about. I know that as government we are always told about the use of consultants, but I think what needs to be appreciated is that there are certain skills that in government we do not necessarily have in-house, and perhaps in some areas we cannot afford to have in-house. But what we have done as a department, we've done an assessment of some of the skills that we need to have in-house because of the functions being called to a department, like a day-to-day job. We cannot go out on that. But the need for consultants will always remain in regard to some of the areas which require expert knowledge or expertise that we cannot have on a continuous basis within the department. So in terms of the areas that relate to regulation, we've looked at the issue of legislative drafting, which historically we've always done through consultants. The policy research, which was always done through consultants. Those are things that we've identified as things that should be in-house, because your day-to-day function. And therefore, we've done that analysis, but I'm sure that Sarah will speak to that, because actually it cuts across the department. But it's that analysis that is important to do, so that we can determine the level of consultants that we might need at any given time. The DT has touched on the CIPRO issues. I'm not going to touch on that. But the last part is really around the fronting issues. Because we handle company investigations on governance issues and all of that, the trend that we've seen is that a lot of companies use directors for BEE purposes, and after that, they'll remove them from the structure. Once they get the deal, then they remove the person. And they would use then the CIPRO register and all of that to remove them from the company register and all of that. So we've been seeing an increase in those cases, and what we are doing right now is to just do a report that shows the trends, which we'll then submit to, obviously, the BEE Advisory Council that has been recently appointed, because it's looking at that space. Because the gap is in regard to the enforcement mechanism within the BEE legislation, and that is what the BEE Advisory Council is looking at right now. But we are aware of those challenges, and we are working on them. Thank you very much.
Okay. No, thank yes, thanks, DG. Thanks, Honorable Chair. The upgrading of posts or promotion of posts, where we are showing more males and women being upgraded or promoted. We need to understand that when we grade posts, we don't look at people. We would grade posts, looking at the post, what is the post requirement, what is the content, and so forth. In terms of promotion, in terms of appointments, we've indicated that we've got an EE plan that is looking into that. The DG has given you some stats in terms of where we are in terms of ensuring that we empower women and people with disability. So there's an issue of EE and there's an issue of grading of posts. So these are two distinct processes that we follow. Just to latch on the issue of consultants, the DG, when he presented, he talked to the issue of the challenge. One of the challenges that we have, obviously, is the issue of skills. So when we talk about consultants, we must always be mindful that we'd have to augment because we cannot afford to come to commit to the committee and say we couldn't do this because of the skill shortage and so forth. So what we do from our side, we look at where are we, where do we need expert skill and so forth, and then what we do is we would go out and source that. But also part of the process is the transfer of skills, and we're hoping that is one thing over some time, because again, it cannot be something that is done overnight. So we would in due course, we would see that upskilling taking place through this process. The higher resignation rate, again, here we're talking about the skills challenge in the country, where we have to compete with private sector, and that's why you'd see the people resigning, because we the kind of work that you do, if you look at the kind of work that we do, the kind of skills that we would have in the department, obviously you have institutions like financial institutions and so forth also wanting those kind of skills. So that is why you would see the resignations being high. But if you look at our turnover rate, it's gone down. I mean, we're looking at 4.5%, whereas the going rate is around 10%. So I think we, from our side, we believe that we are managing the issue of turnover very well. Performance agreements, some of the reasons really are not sound. We are putting measures in place to ensure that we know some of the issues, and basically, we're saying that we would obviously be taking disciplinary actions, but we would still have where there are disputes. Obviously, we need to ensure that there's a fair process that we deal with those issues around performance agreements. Where there are disputes, you need to follow due process and so forth. But when the reasons are not found, in line with the public service framework, we would be taking disciplinary action against those affected. Issues around the contingent liabilities. As most of the contingent liabilities, as indicated there, talks to litigation matters that are still, you know, with the court and so forth. The big one of the 2 billion talks to the Italian matter that the DG has talked about, where now you won't see it going forward because that matter has been settled. So, but it's not claims that it's realized. Obviously, they are waiting the outcomes of the court for them to come out. The PPP agreement. Basically, we didn't have money to build ourselves, you know, an office, office space and so forth. So we've partnered with the private sector. They provided the funding, and that is why we have this arrangement. It has gone through fair processes of, you know, procurement and so forth. And the details really, we can make those available. But it was a fair and transparent process, understanding that this is one of the processes that has been followed to ensure that we can cooperate with the private sector. Just on the matters that are coming from the audit report, the issue of the organizational structure that was not approved. The structure has been approved. It's just more of a timing issue. And maybe like just to contextualize that, the department wouldn't have a situation where the structure, we have structures that are not approved. Because each and every post that gets created has to follow a due process. Because depending on its level, it would go up to the DG. If it's a senior management position, it has to go to the DPSA. So this is the audit was really talking to the structure in terms of the minister just approving everything. But in terms of all the posts that have been created, there are proper processes and approvals in place. So it's important that we understand this, because it creates an impression as if we've got structures that were not approved. But this particular review, where the minister will submit everything,
for the minister to sign off was done in June, subsequent to the closure of this financial year. The disciplinary cases, the member who raised this question is not around, but basically like the DJ has indicated, from our side, we follow a due process where people, those who have been charged are given a fair hearing. If the outcome is not favorable to them, we implement the decisions. If they have to be dismissed, we dismiss them. If there are any criminal charges that have to be obviously instituted, we do that. So those are the issues. But the challenge that we have, again, is the processes that are not within the department. You lay a charge, obviously, with SAPS and so forth, and those are the processes that we find that they tend to drag and so forth. But from our side, we take the entire process forward. The CFO might want to talk to one or two issues around the regular expansion.
Thanks, DG, for that. But the issue is that we really enjoy and like the engagement with the department. We need in future to find a better way to improve it. And because members are really interested, because it reflects on their work and their constituencies. Other areas, I'm sure, we'll have to come back and discuss some specific issues. For instance, even with the issue of consultants, we still have to engage on that area. You shouldn't get a consultant to hire another consultant. So I'm happy with that. Thanks very much to the Mazaman.
I'm not entirely happy with that. I'd be happy if my questions, which haven't been answered, are answered in writing, and then I'll be entirely happy.
Are they mainly the questions that are to be answered by the CFO?
I think it's a range of questions.
Honorable Nyambi?
Chair. Not all the questions have been answered, but it's clear that we are not going to do justice. We don't have time. So it's not only the issue of Mazambat, but they've tried their best. They've responded to almost more than 90% of the questions. And we see some of us are going to have a second round. So let's agree that there's nothing that we can do beyond what we've done today. Time is against us.
No, I would support that. In actual fact, it wouldn't do any harm if we have another briefing on certain issues. We'll just identify them, pick them up, and say, you know, we'd want to discuss on these issues. All of us then would set these questions and points. Then we'll send it. But thanks very much to the department. DG and officials, we're quite satisfied with the respect that you give to the committee. Thank you very much for continuing this direction. So we'll hear from you, we'll hear from us very soon, from Supera. Thanks very much. And I hope, Zoltan Duli, the issues that we discussed about upcoming bills, you'll follow that up very soon so that we put it in the program. Okay, thanks very much, DJ.
Thank you. On behalf of the officials who accompanied me, thank you very much, and thanks for the questions. Those that we were not able to answer, we will clearly answer in writing, and we do look forward to another opportunity to engage on a few select issues which you will pick up, Chair, and we can prepare for them and come over here to engage. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, you know,